call the March 18, 2025 meeting of the North Bend City Council to order. Please call the roll. Mrs. Clerk, go ahead.
Mayor Pro Tem Mark Jocelyn.
Present.
Councilmember Brendan Elwood.
Present.
Councilmember Alan Gotthelf.
Here.
Councilmember Heather Cullen.
Here.
Councilmember Christina Restic.
Here.
Councilmember Susan Torgerson.
Here.
Councilmember Errol Tremolata.
Here.
All are present, Your Honor.
I think he knows that.
Use our stage voice.
You know?
Outside voice, but inside for the first time.
You are definitely using your acting voice there.
I think he's breaking the smoke. That was perfect. He's giving us a flight salute.
I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, well, good evening, everybody. We have a bit of a glitch in our audio system for a couple of our wonderful council members. We'll get that corrected immediately. Thank you, Phil. Thank you, everybody, for being here tonight and online. We welcome you at all times since we'll fix your wonderful places. Okay, consent agenda. Now we can move on to our consent agenda. Do you have any items on our consent agenda?
Awesome. Second.
Thank you. Motion made. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries and is unanimous. Thank you again, Phil. Now, before we move on to citizen comments, is anybody on tonight's agenda? If you're attending remotely and would like to see that public comment, please submit your written comments by in person drop-off max, fax or email to sobedolliver.gov by 5 p.m. on the day of the meeting. You're no longer taking public comments for those attending remotely by Zoom unless you have reached out for a city clerk in advance of the meeting to request accommodation. We'll now move on to citizen comments. At this time, if you'd like to comment on an item that's not on our agenda tonight, we're going to invite you to come forward to the podium. If you request accommodation, would the city clerk wish to speak during citizen comments, please raise your hand through the virtual platform and we will take your comments after the person comments. Please use your number, state your name, your address, and you need to speak.
Okay. There she is. Welcome. Hello, hello, Mr. Guys. So, Deborah Ladd is 14615 438th Avenue Southeast. And I'm here on behalf of North Bend Art Ministry. I just have a couple of announcements. We've moved. I don't know if you guys have noticed because we were in a closet and now we're not. So, I'm very excited about it. We had a great volunteer event the week after we moved, the first weekend in February. About 20 people came out to help us paint and prep and move all everything out of our old space so that we didn't have double rents that we were paying. So that was awesome. And then we started immediately teaching classes at the new location. We're still moving in, still renovating, but using it fully, which is exciting. And one of the things that I wanted to talk about is some of the after-school programs that we're now able to start. So in April, we have our first part-time staff member coming on board to be able to give us hours of operation where the doors are open. And part of what we wanted to make sure is that we were incorporating after-school activities. So every Thursday, there's going to be a team meetup. It's a maker meetup that will include science and technology. So the facilitator that is running our Center for Creativity will have at least four projects. Three of them will be art and creation related, and one will be around science and technology. And those will change up every single week. So there will be something new for our young folks to try out and experience. They can also bring their own projects and get help with those projects too. So we're excited about an after-school weekly option for kids from 12 to 18. And then I think it's in May, we're going to start a Sunday 6 to 10-year-old meetup. Same kind of idea, many projects for kids to try out and experience at no cost. and just a chance for again, some options for creativity that aren't available currently. I also want to remind you that Art Off the Rails is on the books. We will be having that festival on June the 21st, and this year, please pray to the sun gods. It's our third year. I really need great weather. We have a really good lineup of musicians, three different ones that are all have a different style of music, which will be very fun. Within the first, I would say, 3 hours of opening up the artist applications, we had about 32 applicants. So we're just about full, and it's been the artist applications have been open for about a week. So there's a real hunger for artists to have a chance to show and sell their work and then combine with kind of the whole festival atmosphere. So please put June 21st on your calendar, save the date, it is a really fun event, and maybe you want to pack an umbrella too, just in case.
And appointments. Item number 9 is introductions. And here tonight is our acting police chief, Gary Gracie, and he's here to introduce our newest, greatest, and latest officer. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you, Mayor, council members, city staff, and those attending, both in person and online. I want to introduce our newest officer on the road. He's in FTO now, starting week 2, so as of tomorrow. This is Mr. Mosar. He was hired with us on October 1st of 2024. He graduated the academy on the 5th of March. Prior to coming to us, he worked in the HVAC system, so he has a little bit of experience from Washington Energy Services. He's also a member of the Washington Army National Guard. He joined them in 2021 and is a truck driver for them. He graduated from Boarding High, and is following in his father's footsteps, who is a federal way officer. So this is Officer Will Spartan, and I'll open the floor to him for a minute.
Well, welcome, officer.
I just want to say I'm thankful for being hired on here. I really love to come up here as a little kid, climb outside with my father a couple times. So I'm just glad to be here and glad to get started.
Terrific. Any comments the council would like to say at this moment, or to the officer?
Sure. Thank you for joining North Bend Snoqualmie as a police officer. We have always been grateful to have new people hired.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm just going to say, I've mentioned now for the third time this weekend, because your graduation was entirely emotionally charged and fun. An opportunity to meet your family was wonderful. Your dad, who's a really fabulous officer in the Federal Way of Relief. Is that correct?
Yes. Okay.
So I'm going to come up there for a photo op if you're ready for me. I'm totally shaking. I'm stand up. I am shaking. Right there. I couldn't feel happier. This is a message for you. I believe it's hard to hear online. You're having some struggles.
There's some technical difficulties.
Okay, well, we're working on it, people. You have to be aware. Okay, item number 10 is Presentation Center for Public Safety Management. Jared Erdogan, welcome tonight. Of the Center of Public Safety Management is here tonight to provide a presentation to us on public services, police service studies. Jared, welcome.
Good evening, Mayor and Council. Thank you very much for the opportunity to come here. CPSN was contracted by the city of Lincoln. We were having a discussion about the future of police services in the community. We came in with, we started this project off with a discussion with the previous city manager that kind of highlighted some of the concerns that Northland had with the increase in cost for supplying the providing services, asked us to focus on largely what it would take for the city of Northland to start its own police department, what it would look like from a staffing profile, and then provide the pros and cons of the contracting versus doing it yourself. So, Lee, are you going to explain it? So if we can advance it. So just a little bit about CPSN. CPSN stands for the Center for Public Safety Management. It was founded about 30 plus years ago as a division of the International City and County Management Association, SCMA. It has since broken off into its own private company. In that amount of time, CPSN has done well over 450 studies, roughly, of police agencies around the country. The primary bread and butter, I will say, CPSN is the data analytics piece that they use to determine appropriate staffing levels for police departments based upon workload, not based upon population metrics or what the necessary community thinks it needs, but based upon generally accepted metrics on what staffing should be based upon the workload in the community. We've got a model that I will talk about a little bit during the presentation. The names that you see up on the board, Thomas Wesner, Leonard Matteries, and Doug Shells are the three owners of the company, the founding members. Leonard's name is still up there. He just recently passed away. But they've owned the company for many, many years. Doug Shells is the director of quantitative analytics. Doug and his team, including Sean, worked with Issaquah PD, since that's where your CAD system, your CAD data is captured for this community, and did the entire data piece of this report. So the report, if any of you have seen it, I assume everybody has, about 110 pages altogether. The back part of that report is that analytics piece. That was produced by Doug and Sean. And then the main body of the report was produced by myself and Craig Younger. We are both retired police chiefs. Craig is a retired police chief up in northern Oregon, and I was a police chief in Southern California. Both have been retired for a few years now, and needed this type of work now. And then our editor on this is Dan Stuber. Next slide, please. So as I started off, our purpose here was to really evaluate the options for North Bend. One element was, what does it look like to create your own police department? And then the other were the options of continuing with Snoqualmie PD or considering a contract with King County Sheriff's Department. We did not go at this project or the intent to build your agency with any bottom dollar in mind. We didn't seek to build an agency that was less than or anything like that in any of your contracting options. We went at it from a peer data piece that factored in a number of things. It factored in workload, it factored in relief factors, and it factored in some basic officer safety tenets that are necessary in establishing a police department. The methodology we did on this, they talked about a significant data collection piece. Snoqualmie PD currently provides services to your community, as you know. Snoqualmie PD contracts with the Issaquah Police Department to provide dispatch services, so that is where you have that. All of your calls for service and those records reside for the city. So we worked with Issaquah PD to extract that CAD data in the city of North Bend, not necessarily both North Bend Snoqualmie, but just the North Bend data. We also had extensive interviews with people from both Snoqualmie PD and representatives of your city. We were here on site at least one time before, made observations, they were right along, did a number of those interviews, and of course the data analytics piece. Next slide, please. So, I am not going to go through the entire 10 pages of the report that we've been here for far too long, I know that's not what you want. But I do want to at least provide an explanation to the data that you see in the report so that you can see how we came to our conclusions and why we came to our conclusions on necessary staffing levels. So, as I said, CPSN is very good with the data that they analyze, and they use the generally accepted staffing metric that we refer to as the Rule of 60. And the Rule of 60 has two parts. If an agency has a police department, part of that Rule of 60 says that at least 60% of its sworn workforce should be dedicated to patrol function. Patrol function is the most visible element of any police department in the country. It is the primary point of contact for those citizens, and it is literally what every citizen sees in that community. And at least 60% of that department should be dedicated to that function. And that seems like it's a given. That seems like that's where most people would normally be. But we have seen a number of times in agencies all around the country where they have started to move people around, and they've created specialized units here and there, and they've got other administrative assignments, and suddenly they've only got 45 or 50% sitting in their patrol force, and they're upset because they're not able to meet their service demands. And so that's why that piece of the rule of secrecy exists. And then the second part is, of those people that are working the patrol function, we don't want to see their workload exceed 60% of their live on-duty time. And there's a reason for that. We define global work as community-initiated calls for service. So anybody that calls the police and says they need an officer for anything at all. Officer-initiated work, anything that an officer proactively does to make a traffic stop, a stop assist, and whatever it might be. And then the administrative piece that goes along with that, the report writing, all of the things that an officer also has to do associated with their job. And we don't want to see that total workload for a patrol officer exceed 60%. And the reason being is the patrol force is out there to do a couple of things. It's to respond to community calls for service in a safe and efficient way. But your patrol force is also that piece that is has to have proactive time, so to speak. And that proactive time means they can't be going call and be busy 100% of the time. They have to be available to respond to emergencies. They have to be available to respond to certain other types of community policing needs. And they have to be available to respond to certain management directed or city directed activities. So we set that 60% number, not so that they can have 40% free time, but so that there's a decent part of their shift and their entire work time to be able to do other things. Now that doesn't happen 100% of the time every single day. Some days they are busy all day long. Some days they have more than 40% of that available time. That is simply an average that is placed in there. And part of the science kind of behind that, when they have done studies, is that when an officer works in an environment where they're going call to call, they find that officers will not do proactive work. They won't do those extra things that you want your patrol force to do, because they know the next call is coming, so I'm not going to do anything proactive for fear of not being available for that next call. So that's why we build in that buffer. As I said, we look for, after we develop those staffing metrics, we look to establish minimum staffing levels for patrol, right? We work to establish what proper supervision of those patrol officers should be, and then we build in what we refer to as a relief factor. So police work is not like a lot of other things where if somebody calls in sick, somebody just may not be, sitting in that particular chair that particular day. If you establish minimum staffing numbers, you have said, we will at minimum have a certain number of officers out all the time. So what the relief factor means is, we know that people have days off, we know that they get scheduled vacation, we know that sometimes they get sick, sometimes they have to go to training, sometimes they might get injured, whatever it might be. We have an established relief factor that we've seen in agencies all around the country that is typically somewhere between 25 and 30% of your workforce, maybe off at any given time. So you've got to be able to account for that when you actually build your staffing numbers. And I'll talk about where we build that in later on in this presentation. And then we move to develop the supporting structure for that patrol force. What does management look like? What does the investigative capacity look like? What does the administrative needs of the agency look like? And that's how we came up with your total numbers. Next slide, please. So this is an example of some of the data that you see. That appendix part of the report, the data piece that's in the back of your report, is completely full of tables and graphs. There are many of them in there. These are two of them that are included. And then in the main body of the report, previous to the appendix, are some of these graphs and tables, and with an explanation attached to it to talk about the workload. So, as an example, in the workload for the city of North Bend, there were a total of 5,237 events that occurred. Now, events are a little different than calls for service. And the reason they're a little different is they are in reality calls, but typically there wasn't a measurable response to that call. And we call those zero on scene. So in your data, 383 times during the 12 months of data that we evaluated, you had a zero on scene. So we would eliminate those from the events to actually talk about your calls for service. Now, the 383 events, just for explanation for clarity, doesn't mean something didn't happen. It is kind of the efficiency of the police work. Maybe an officer saw a call on the CAT screen, picked up the telephone, made a call to the reporting party, resolved it over the phone, and then just told dispatch, hey, you can clear it to its own off the screen, I can't put it on the phone. Well, unfortunately, dispatch through the CAT system did not capture the full workload that went into that because the officer handled it kind of off the record in a way. And so those were eliminated from the record. At the end of the day, you were left with 2,645 community-initiated calls for service in the community for an average of 7.2 per day. And then the police-initiated work, the proactive work that happened on top of that, were another 2,200 events, or an average of 6 per day. In the main part of the report, there are dozens and dozens of tables and figures. And then in addition to that, at the very back is the community profile for the city of North Bend. It talks about your population numbers, where you compare to other Washington communities, what your crime rate is. As you guys know, you've got a very safe community. You were significantly below both the state and national averages on crime in both categories. So, next slide. So then what you'll see, this is where we get into factoring in workload. So these are the police-initiated work and the officer-initiated work profiles for the city of North Bend done by Snowball police officers during different periods. So you will have four different periods that you will see these graphs in the report. Two of them are for winter, two of them are for summer. They are both 8-week periods during the winter and during the summer. And then we have one set during summer weekends, another set summer weekdays. The same thing for winter. And the reason we break that down is that in many communities, the workload profile is different in the winter versus the summer, depending on the type of community that you have, and whether you're a residential or an entertainment type place, whatever it is, that workload changes in different communities. So we look in depth at those four seasons. So this particular example is not that it was any worse or better than the others, it's just an example so that you can understand what it says. So this is winter weekdays during the winter period of 2024, during our analysis period. Everything you see in orange is essentially community-initiated work, community calls for service. So that you can see it, basically the 10 o'clock hour, the actual community-initiated or community calls for service took up about 0.7 of an officer on average during that period of time. And then if you look at 7 o'clock p.m., where it says 19 at the bottom, the bottom is essentially midnight to midnight during the course of the day. And then the vertical column is the number of officers occupied with that work. So if we go to 7 o'clock, where it says 19, suddenly that community-initiated work goes up to 0.8 officers. And then when you add in the additional officer-initiated work on top of that, you come out to about 1.2 officers max workload at that particular time. And that's, like I said, that's for both winter and summer, weekends and weekdays are included in the report. Next slide. So what we basically determine is your staffing, the required staffing for the actual workload in the city of North Bend is about one officer. On average, one officer can handle the actual workload that occurs here at any given point during the day. However, in police work, we never just have one officer. Basic officer safety reasons mean that two officers get dispatched to a very, very large percentage of calls, anything that involves potential fight, anything domestic in nature, anything that can be suspicious, anything that has that increased possibility that's going to raise an officer safety concern. And there's a number of reasons for that. Even though one officer could very well handle it, the possibility that it could not be handled well by that one officer, then causing that one officer to potentially get into a violent confrontation, means that that one officer is probably going to need to use more force than they otherwise would have to, if they had to. The mere presence of a second officer during many of those calls tends to soften the risk in and of itself, just the mere presence. So from an officer safety standpoint, you've got to have at least two people on duty. So we built your schedule based upon a 12-hour scheduling matrix. In law enforcement all around the country, there are three primary 24-hour, 7-day-a-week scheduling profiles. It's an 8-hour scheduling profile, a 10-hour scheduling profile, or a 12. The benefits of the 8s and the 12s is that they factor into 24, so that you don't necessarily have overlap shifts. And the benefits of the 10s is that if you have a call load that really spikes during certain parts of the day, you have an overlap shift and you know that there's two shifts to handle that increased workload during that time. In the profile for the one that there's not necessarily a need for the 10s, the one that factors into 24 is fine, so we built it with a 12-hour schedule. So you can see team 1 and 2, for instance, are both on one squad working the same day of the week but opposite sides of the day. One will work the AM 12-hour, one will work the PM 12-hour. We built it with one corporal and one officer. The corporal would be essentially a working supervisor type position. This is just our recommendations. And then teams 3 and 4 would work the opposite side of the week, again with one corporal, one officer. And then we threw in for your relief factor purpose, so that if any one of those officers ends up not being available on team 1, 2, 3, or 4, you have team 1A and team 3A, which is essentially just one officer that kind of works the cover of those shifts, that can be pulled in either direction to fill in on either teams 1 or 2 or 3 or 4, based upon the needs. Yes?
I worked all our shifts, so we call it 90% FTE. And so you would work 3 12-hour shifts in a week. So in that case, how many officers would we need? So and where does the overlap? Because that's 6 shifts, and there's 7th, right? 7 days a week.
Okay. So I'll go over your staffing numbers, I think, in the next slide.
Okay.
But to answer your question very quickly, you are right, that really only covers 6 days of the week, right? So on that other shift every other week, one of those teams has to work 4 days. So you're going to work 4 on, 3 off, 3 on, 4 off.
And in that case, do they get overtime?
There's automatic 4 hours of overtime built into that schedule based upon that profile, which is very common around management that we see. So total patrol staffing, these are just the patrol officers, is one sergeant who really serves in kind of an administrative role managing the patrol teams, 4 corporals who are your de facto working supervisors, and then 6 officers. One paired up with corporals on each of those teams 1 through 4, and then the relief factor officers on teams 1A and 3A. That's right. So this is a graph, an organizational chart, so to speak, of what a proposed North End Police Department would or should look like based upon our recommendations and things that we often see. So, because it's a relatively small agency, I think 17 FTEs altogether is what we run into this. Because it's a relatively small agency, there's not necessarily a need to have a deep chain of command separating patrol from the chief. An agency this size, in reality, the chief is the patrol commander. The chief is making day-to-day decisions concerning patrol. But we have an operations sergeant in there for the administrative duties related to it. And we can talk about some of those as it applies to scheduling, vacation, body camera reviews, all those types of things that go along with managing a patrol squad. And then each of those 6 teams that we discussed all of you there. And then on the other side, we have another administrative sergeant with one detective assigned to handle the investigative overflow that patrol would not be able to handle. I think it's very similar to the structure that Snoqualmie provides, except in the case of Snoqualmie, that second officer on another ship is essentially a rover that goes back and forth between Snoqualmie and North Bend on an as-needed basis. In this case, because they would all be North Bend officers in your own standpoint department, we had to build it into your agency and not as a shared asset between the two communities. Next slide. So this is the full staffing profile. One police chief, 2 sergeants that would essentially be the administrative positions we talked about before. Some agencies would choose to call those a lieutenant position. That's ultimately your choice on what you would want to call it if you were to choose to go down this road. The 4 corporals, that would be your de facto shift supervisors, you know, for every day of the week. 8 police officers to fill those needs. And we have one detective. In reality, that detective will probably also be a full position from a payroll standpoint. That's a total of 16 sworn officers altogether and one administrative assistant working for the agency as a civilian, handling records and all the administrative things that normally go there, for a grand total of 17 FTE equivalents for the agency. Now, we worked with city officials to really come up with your cost for those positions. That's something that it would be difficult for us to give you an exact number for obvious reasons. We don't know exactly what you're going to want to pay a police officer, as my chief knows. That's really your discretion to build your pay scale where you want it. But at the end of the day, you've got to be within a competitive market to attract talent into the position. So we work with city officials to come up with that number. Also apply the existing North Bend benefit package to it, because that becomes part of the cost as well. And then just to be safe, so that we were not underestimating, we add, I think Craig added, 20% above that total personnel cost, which would leave you with about $4.5 million a year just in personnel cost. And then the report outlines a great number of all of the other ancillary operating costs, from building a CAD system, having vehicles, police station, all those types of things, excluding the cost of the station itself, because you don't have one. I know that's another discussion you're having one. Excluding that, that would be about another $750,000, approximately on top of that figure, would be our estimated annual cost of operating the department in today's environment. Next slide. So, you have this, I've seen this in also documents that you highlighted in the back row. We have them throughout the report. What are the pros of North Bend electing to start their own police department? Obviously, you would have greater control of all things policing in the community. You would essentially be your department. It would be a police chief that reports directly to you. It would be employees that are full-time employees of the city of North Bend, and you have control over managing and directing their activities on a day-to-day basis. The city will be able to balance personnel costs against the labor market. So under your contracting things, you have, I know what started this discussion was frustration over the increase in cost from one year to another. If you want your own police department, you have greater control over that. Not full control, you still have to compete in the market, but you will be set greater control as to how you absorb those costs. And of course, you have the option to defer some of those costs when necessary, whether it's maintenance or equipment replacement or whatever it might be. The cons, of course, is that you're responsible for running a police department, and that is not necessarily an easy thing. And there are small communities all over that have found it to be a very, very frustrating endeavor to try to do. It is hard for a small police department, and this would be a relatively small police department, it is hard for a small police department to handle large things, to have search capacity. A single vacancy in a small police department becomes very, very difficult to manage, whereas, we commonly see around the country, even though police departments are catching up in their post, 2020 era staffing shortages, we are seeing a lot of departments catch up in their staffing, but it's still very common to see a 5 to 10% vacancy rate in police departments around the country. And that's kind of a normal operational level that is frequently seen in agencies everywhere. So you're responsible for all those if you own it yourself. You own all the liability for what they do out in the field. And of course, you're going to have a relatively small department limited capacity. And it's probably a little bit more expensive option than the contracting option. At least that's our experience when we've assessed it in other communities. Next slide. So I didn't separate Snoqualmie from King County. I know that's part of the larger discussion. But the pros and cons are very similar to the contracting piece as well. The pros to it is that you don't have to concern yourself with the day-to-day options or the day-to-day concerns that pop up. You don't have to concern yourself very much with the HR issues that come with operating a police department, including injuries and staffing challenges and those types of things. You have less startup costs associated with contracting, whether you continue with Snoqualmie, where you already own a couple of police cars, or you go to King County. Those startup costs are significantly less than what it would be to start your own. And you will have access to greater search capacity. So as I just talked about with your current contract with Snoqualmie, you share at least one officer every shift that rovers back and forth between communities as a backing officer in one place or the other based upon where they're needed, where in your own department you would have to have both on duty in the city. So you have greater search capacity with those other agencies. You have greater investigative capacity, certainly with King County Sheriff's Department being a very large agency, would be able to bring a lot of assets to the table for any particular problem that you might have, that you probably would not have the capacity to have in-house with your own agency. And of course, contracting is generally less expensive depending on how the agency structures the contract and how they calculate the cost. Of course, the cons are you have less operational and budgetary control. The contracting agency makes those decisions, and unless they're spelled out in your contract, you limit the decisions that they make. That's just the way it does. And you have limited control over cost increases, as you've seen. So one of the other agencies decides to give their police officer a 25% raise to be more competitive in the environment, or in the labor environment, that 25% is probably going to be passed along to you the following year and the cost. With that said, I intentionally did not go through the entire 110 page report because there's a lot of detail in there, but I'm certainly be able to answer any questions if you have.
Thank you, Mr. Ridwan, for that kind of presentation. Anybody, Council, any questions for Mr. Ridwan?
So out of the three options in the cities that you have seen that have chosen different options, in your opinion, what seems to work best?
Are you
our own police department contracting with Snoqualmie or contracting with the sheriff department?
So this is my opinion. I would say that if you would have asked me that question 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, it made no sense for a city that was already contracting with another agency to start their own department. It's difficult. It's complicated. It is not the same as, and I realize that you look at the history of many agencies that were started 40, 50, 100 years ago with one town marshal, so to speak, that just grew into a modern day police force. You can't just flip a switch with one town marshal and start a department today. You've got to kind of have everything set up from day one. And that means taking a year or two to build an entire agency, absorb those costs while you're still contracting, and then picking the magic date in the future and flipping the switch and doing it. And I think that the common answer for communities 5, 10 years ago was it makes no sense in the world to do that. With that said, there are a number of communities in this country. We've done several projects on this ourselves. I've seen in my own professional career in Southern California where agencies were getting very, very frustrated with contracting agencies because contracting agencies may promise you a certain number of people, and because they have vacancies, you're not really getting those people, but you're still paying for it. And then the contracting agency says, yeah, but you know, you're kind of getting it because we got staff with overtime, and things would get very, very convoluted. And so we've seen a number of communities that have been very, very frustrated with those experiences with contracting agencies that have gone down the road of starting their own police department, and most of them have found it to be something that they're very, very proud of. I will still tell you, this is a small enough community that you're probably better served with a partnership doing some form of a regionalized model, whether you continue contracting or you form a joint powers authority with other cities. But somehow, if you can share those expenses, because as I said, your workload profile doesn't say that you need two people on duty in this community 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So as long as you have shared search capacity, so that an officer who's doing anything in this community can have a backing officer when they need it, so that there can be a greater level of officer safety that's present, and you can have search capacity, if you can partner and share those expenses with somebody else, with whatever agency, in a contracting or JPA type environment, I believe that is probably the better option for you. That's just unfiltered honesty on it.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Mr.
Yeah, you made a comment. You estimated that, and I don't know if there's a number you got from Snoqualmie, 1.5 officers patrolling on a daily basis within North Bend. Is that the number you got from them, or is that the exact number of what you see have heard to be? Because that's kind of a good.
So, I just want to make sure I'm clear. Are you talking about the data piece where it showed the workload piece in the report, or was it a statement that I made?
A statement you made that said that there's you're effectively getting 1.5 officers through Snoqualmie
So that is based upon our interviews with Snoqualmie PD. When we had interviews with them and we talked about what the staffing profile is, Snoqualmie told us that their average, their daily minimum staffing, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, was a minimum of three. At least two officers and a sergeant, sometimes three officers and a sergeant. And when they had that profile of the two officers, they would assign one to North Bend, one to Snoqualmie, and then the sergeant would be a rover that would go back and forth when a second officer was needed. So that might be where you get the 1.5 officers. But Snoqualmie also said if it's a day that they have four, their typical staffing would be two in North. This just came from them. We weren't able to validate this with data. But it would be two in North Bend, one in Snoqualmie is the way they would schedule it with the rover that would still go back and forth and spend most of their time in Snoqualmie. I hope I'm not messing my cities because I've said it so many times. But does that make sense?
Yeah.
Now here's, I think, the important part. When you're looking at the data and you see the workload, you know, you see on there that really at no point does it, does workload go all the way up to two officers. Remember, that's average, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week over the entire evaluation period. That doesn't mean there weren't a lot of times that you had two or three officers. In fact, in the data report, you will see several hundred calls during the course of the year where there were, I think, even three officers on a single call here in the city. So there's times where there were significantly more than just that 1.5. But I think the 1.5 would be the average based upon the way the quality of the city.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it. Wanted to follow up on the last time you answered Councilman Coleman on. So, in your experience, when you're seeing cities exploring more and more their own department over time now versus 10 years ago, what are some of the, I know you said population isn't really the key metric to kind of gauge, but what are you seeing most commonly reasons to start that planning process? I think there's also the realities of making a decision for us in the near term versus additionally making a decision for the long term, and whether that's the same decision or something now and something different later. How do we, in your experience, how can we gauge what metrics we're tracking? I know we're growing, it's key, you're saying, but we're growing city, right? We're 8,000 now. In 10 years, we may be 10, 11, 12. What should we be tracking? And then kind of secondly on that, how does our town situation maybe be unique in that, you know, we're a mountain town, we have a lot of recreation, so some of the mutual aid stuff, whether it's search and rescue, marine, SWAT, and other things that, you know, we may need because of the terrain that we live by, and people living on the 90 corridor, which is tons of transient crime, as well as actually live in North Bend, but we can't see it as specifically our outlet mall, you know, but.
So let me try to answer that. In the agencies that I have seen, I'm working on an agency right now that is in the state of Georgia. I've seen this in a couple communities in Southern California. The driving factor was frustration with their relationship with the contracting agency that finally led to a conversation of, well, what does it take for us to just do this ourselves? Because when you're contracting, for many communities, it's kind of like, hey, we don't have to worry about any issues. Manager, right? Because there's a lot that goes into it. And you know, any city that runs a department will tell you about the HR issues and some of those things, that, you know, the injuries and that sort of stuff that happens with police department can be frustrating. So those agencies or those cities that I've seen that are finally gone down that road to do it and they can worry about the institutions have typically been 30,000 people type communities to build a large enough agency where there's a large enough tax base so that you have your own search capacity in many ways. Let me answer the question. With a department like this, when you basically have everybody working, you do essentially two people 24/7, occasionally you have a third overlap officer. If you have a significant festival in town or a weekend event, and I know you're kind of that winter destination, you have surge population during certain types of season, where do you find the extra people to do that work? Right? Would you have the option to say, okay, we need on this particular day because of a special event, we need Issaquah and Snoqualmie and King County to provide extra labor? That's an option to you. That might make perfect sense, even though you don't need it on a day-to-day basis. So the frustrating piece has been relationships and the way they've broken down. The Because operating a fish farm will, in many cases, almost always be more expensive than a contracting option. At some point, though, that local control and that sense of pride of saying this is our community's department starts to outweigh the cost issues.
Actually, my question was similar to the Councilmember Tremolata's, that, yeah, just key indicators of where we need to pay attention to, you know, as we continue to grow. So I think you've answered it, so I appreciate that.
Anybody else have any questions? Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
I can listen to all 100 pages.
And we now have another presentation from our very own Martin Shaw, and his director here at the city. Welcome, Martin, to the podium.
Can you go ahead and share my screen? Have two documents on the desk. In this first one, and Councilor, you see this. So this is your two documents at the desk. Well, first of all, for the record, Martin Shaw, financial director of City Council. As I mentioned, there are two documents for your review. The first one is a memorandum from Bob to you all on the, on the cost of forming your own police department. As you recall, and as Chief Bird mentioned, the city's got to review three options. Contracting with, continuing contract with the city's economy, contracting with perhaps City County will form your own police department. And to the matter, I reached out to one of our architectural partners. This is Integris Architecture. They are based in Spokane. It's a Pacific Northwest architectural firm with offices in Spokane, Portland, as well as Seattle. They've done many civic buildings, including police stations, libraries, schools, universities, as well as hospitals. And my question to them was, if the city's work then were interested in forming its own police department and creating a police building for them, what would that police building look like? I won't go over the analysis in detail, but on the summary page from the podcast, I'll prepare for you. We're looking at about a 6,500 square foot building, large enough to house about 20 to 25 FTEs, and about 10 to 12 FTEs per shift. Estimated cost is about $6 million. This is about $4.5 million in terms of construction costs, and about $1.5 million in terms of solid costs, which includes design, engineering permits, as well as FF&E or furnishings, fixtures, and equipment.
Could you describe what 10 to 12 FTEs per shift means for the regular people?
So this would be the number of FTEs that would be required to be on site, either providing administration support as well as the patrol officers. So as Chief Perry mentioned, each shift would have two officers, or two patrol officers. So two patrol officers would be part of the active duty staff that would be on site, and then we would have the chief, the assistant chief, as well as support staff.
So 10 to 12 hours per shift.
Right, that would be 10 to, about 10 to 12 FTEs spread over a 24-hour period. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. So maybe you could describe it a little bit better for layman. This would be one officer working 10-hour shift or one officer working a 12-hour shift.
That's right. or possibly one officer working an 8-hour shift, so they would be three shifts. So again, it depends on how the city would set it up.
Okay.
Basic building amenities, a public lobby, a service counter, community training room, sally port for transporting persons, as well as administrative space, patrol operations space, evidence processing room, storage area, interview room, restrooms for the public, as well as for staff, locker room, as well as a fitness area. In terms of financing this, what I've estimated here is about, if we finance this fully, include a general obligation bond for over 20 years at 5%. This is a simple amortization table. What we'll be looking at is about 10 locations of about 500,000 persons. The rest of the document is the memo from Integris. We'll just scroll through this really quickly. They included a schematic as to a site plan. This comes from their work with the city of West Richmond. What we see here is parking, staff parking, sally port, parking space for the police vehicles, the building itself, as well as the outdoor storage area. In terms of what the space might look like, it could look something like this. I forget which city this was from. Integris designed this. And then Integris also went on to do other considerations in terms of future growth or expansion, technology, secured access, which would include key card entries, training in wellness areas, as well as energy efficiency.
If I may, just to be very clear, this is for solely the purposes of comparison to bring information to council. This is nothing that's presently being envisioned, planned. This is new information to us. Whether or not there would be a key card entry system would be determined so far into the future that it isn't worth raising a complaint should you have one, if I may.
That's correct. Okay, any questions on this? Second document we have for you is a follow-up to information that we presented to you at the council retreat. We'll pull it up. SWAT team services or fire investigation services available either through mutual aid or through the small cities task force. Councilman.
So this is new information and contradicts information we discussed in our work study, right? We had a specific conversation around a detective that was being fully charged in North Bend in the proposal because the Small Cities Task Force could not handle additional investigations. So is that available to us now? And then that would beg the question that we should reevaluate the detective need, because we discussed this specific thing in work study.
I would defer that to the acting chief. I believe that there was a temporary issue with the major crimes task force, that they did not have enough staffing. Other departments that would be contributing towards that did not have enough staffing to provide that resource. And I'd ask the acting chief for clarification on that. This is how it was intended to be set up.
Right, okay.
I can address that if you'd like.
Yes.
So, the Major Crimes Task Force is an organization, a group of investigators that is where each agency plus four, an officer or two or three. In our case, we have three on there from Sequoia. Those investigators are called out at the discretion of the Major Crimes Task Force commander and are only for Major Crimes Task Force, or major crimes, I should say. What was happening was, because North Bend did not have any allocation, the previous chief was using them to investigate all major crimes or any investigation purposes, including just a simple assault. That is not something that the Major Crimes Task Force was set up to do. So, what it was done was, now that decision is made by the commander of the task force for who responds and to what calls are responded to. In cases of homicides, sexual assaults, and there's a criteria. Those are just some of those examples. Robberies, things like that. Those are things that meet the criteria. The rest of it falls upon the discretion of that commander. It's not just a group of detectives that respond just because there's an assault that occurred 3 weeks prior that just came forward and now we've got to do it. It's an available source that we use throughout the entire, whether it's Lake Forest Park, Mercer Island, Enumclaw, Snoqualmie, it doesn't matter which one it is. But there's a criteria, and that is set up by the Board of Directors, which is the chiefs of the 12 agencies.
Got it. So it is available.
It is very much available.
But it is not at our discretion or response. This is that's the task force.
So for instance, I can go back to February of 2024 when I was not in this agency. We got called out for a suspicious death, which ended up turning into a homicide here in North Bend. I myself from Enumclaw, I was on duty and responded because it met the criteria.
Yeah.
So those resources are pooled, and we will make calls to the 20-something detectives we have on that team to respond. That has always been available. We've always used it. The problem is it was being abused specifically during a tenure here. And it had to be reined in because we were tying up our resources and investigating crimes that should be handled by the agencies themselves. So it was kind of a rein in on that. It is available, no different than if we have a homicide where there's a major scene we need to investigate, we will pull state patrol in and bring in their crime scene or their crime lab to help us investigate and do the forensic side of it. If we have a vehicular homicide, we will bring in state patrol, or we'll ask King County Mars team to come in and help us assist it. Those resources have always been available. That doesn't change. Those are mutual aid agreements that we have. No different than SWAT or anything else.
Gary, I'm sorry, Mark. Go ahead. I have a really quick question to the presentation.
Yes.
When it comes to helicopters, the use of helicopters, where do they fit into this criteria?
So that is part of the mutual aid. It's part of the mutual aid from King County.
Okay.
They provide it to all agencies, ultimately statewide. So it's always available, just like K-9 is as well.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay, pardon me, Martin. Per your shower system here, the Snoqualmie Police Department has the stars. King County Sheriff doesn't have the stars, means it's already included. And if we had our own police department, they're all starred.
Correct.
So the stars mean we're paying more.
The stars mean that those resources would be available to us either through mutual aid or through the Small Cities Task Force.
Meaning we have to ask for help?
I think the stars simply indicate that they were added since the last time we saw this spreadsheet.
That's correct. Yes.
But the stars have no special significance other than it's a change from prior.
Yes.
But so on this comparison, to be clear, mutual aid is being contracted out, side budget, on an as-needed basis. And when it says included in budget, it's an asset that technically we are paying for and will be available as needed.
That's correct.
So in mutual aid, we could get it without access to it, but we're going to get it built for.
That's right. Well, mutual aid is actually provided. My understanding is that at no cost from the neighboring jurisdiction.
At no cost.
Captain, is that correct? Under mutual aid.
What was that question?
Under mutual aid, is there a cost for that?
I'll start with a coalition of small police agencies. Each agency that's a part of the coalition pays and used to help fund, and they use grant money to help pay and reimburse for overtime that the officers approve or detectives approve while they're doing that, plus money that goes to training and things like that. With mutual aid, there can be just costs associated with it. For instance, one of the things where you may not have costs associated is with Guardian One because they accept grant monies and state and federal funds for operating that helicopter program. However, if an agency has, you could get billed for if you have a canine call out or something, depending on what your actual resources are. So it's a lot of what you agree upon and how those monies are allocated and what your actual resources are before you're asking for somebody else to come in and assist. So that's all set up in what is set up through the through your agreements.
So that was a great explanation. To add to that, though, as a contracting city, we don't get to make those calls on all the things you just said, correct?
So if we have to call out a canine unit right now, I haven't received a bill for the last canine we called out. And we'll ask for, we start with Redmond and other smaller agencies who have canine programs who will bring their dogs out before we go to King County. King County used to charge a lot for those resources, so it's kind of a practice for us to go with other agencies and agencies that will have a quicker response time as well. Because if Redmond has a dog on duty or Renton has a dog on duty, I'm going to ask for those first because they're going to get here quicker.
Okay.
Mr. Ellis.
Thank you for the detail. Sorry to be
It's what I'm here for.
You mentioned something about we get billed depending on our existing resources. So does that mean, say, if we had our own canine unit and it was deployed doing something and we needed to call another agency because we have that resource, we would then get billed for it? But if we don't have the resource, we don't get billed for it?
Generally speaking, yes.
Oh, thank you.
Anybody else want to
I'm back here.
Welcome back, Mark.
Thanks, Peter. My pleasure. Thanks, Captain. Well, I know my dog would make the police force.
It's a video.
Okay, one other change on this page, council is on the very top, officers on patrol. I clarified that it seems funny, it's on one officer on duty and then one floor. And that's the officer that goes back and forth between the two cities as Chief Bourbon mentioned. For King County, base proposal is one, as you see here, the first green high is one officer on duty and then one officer nearby. And then the second column is having two officers in the city at all times. Total FTEs is on the bottom, between 12 and 14 and a quarter, from St. Louis County, between 10.8 and 14.8 for King County, and then 17 for the city operating department. The next page is a summary of the financial details. So under the city of Suquamish options, the current cost is $2.51 million. That's in 2024. The proposed cost in 2025 is $4.05 million. That comes out to an equivalent of between $260,000 to $383,000 per officer, or $304 to $49 per cabinet. You see the comparable metrics there for King County. Their cost ranges between $3.5 million to $4.7 million, and the average cost per officer ranges between $307,000 to $366,000. And the cost per capita is $429,000 to $565,000. And then for the city operating department, assuming a $5.3 million annual operating expense, and that includes the cost of operations plus the debt service for new billing. The estimated cost there is $353,000 per FTE or $644 per capita.
Fire?
Yes,
how should we view the per capita, knowing that we're growing? Like, how are you growing that into? I assume you're using Snapchat today.
That's right. That's based on the population today. And of course, as the city grows, at some point, you know, we would add additional staffing to service that growth. This next chart summarizes the roles and then on the side of this, the cons of each service option. As you can see, this list is a bit lengthier than what we presented to you at the council retreat. What I presented to you at the council retreat was meant to synthesize the pros and cons at a high level for further consideration. After discussions with internally as well as with city of Suquamish staff, we felt that it would be valuable to just in detail the identified pros under each option. I won't go over every single one, but as you can see, the first four, for example, would be Suquamish specific. In terms of familiarity with the city, with staff, with other businesses. The next seven or eight goals or so would be the responsibility or the lack thereof of contracting out operations rather than running our own. And then the last 10 goals or so would be those factors that apply to. Specifically to a city-operated police department. There are some that overlap with King County in that, as you recall, if you contract with King County, there's a police chief that would be assigned and co-located here at City Hall, and that chief would have authority over hiring decisions as well as whatever service and operational decisions for the city. Any questions here at council?
I have one. I'm sorry, it's probably right in front of me. But on the table that has the cost comparisons, when I'm looking at the cost per FTE on the King County value, it goes down, even though there's more FTE. It says, the first column says for the one point, the one and one nearby column, it says
372,000 FTE, and the one for two FTEs says 366,000.
That's right. And that's a factor, Councilman, of having more staff and spreading that, that operating cost over, over a larger staff pool. So that makes your cost per FTE down.
Okay. Thank you.
So, in the next slide, complete control over the budget. In Snoqualmie, we know we don't. King County, I guess we won't. And we have our own, we do. Is there no way, maybe you don't know how to answer this, but we can have some say in the budget?
Well, we would have some say over operations. As you recall from the county's presentation to us, the county offers two steering committees, a finance and a leadership steering committee. Right? And those are committees that are set up very similar to the NEPAC, where the municipal solid waste operation here, the contracted cities, would meet with county officials on a regular basis to discuss either operational or policy concerns and questions. And that I can use the same model that the sheriff's office uses for the finance and leadership steering committees.
Thank you. Anybody else? Okay. Yes, Susan.
I have a quick question. There's something in here about population, and we were just learning from the consultant that we want to base it based on workload, not population. So it seems like that's a metric that doesn't really work for our formula.
You mean
yeah. The data has to do with population, right? So.
That's right. It's just another data point, Councilman Ferguson. Chief Bergen emphasized that the population isn't. Shouldn't be a driving factor for level of services, meeting calls, and the type of calls. But here we presented the cost per capita as simply another data point to consider.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Then, before leaving this slide on pros, if you're dialing, this is just a simple count of the number of bullets under each column. 11, 14, and 5 between controls between contracting with Sequoia, contracting with King County, or former rent. On the next slide, similar table, but this is for the cons. Again, we'll go over to China and detail, but what we see here are the inverse. What are some of the cons for either contracting with Sequoia? Contracting with King County or former home. On the far right, former home, as you can see, will be responsible for many day to day operational requirements, hiring decisions, facility and fleet maintenance, etc. And contracting with King County, identified several there, which include no control over management of the walls. Financial management, and then under Sopani, some of this, including influence over personal decisions, reporting dashboards, as well as the finance and leadership steering committee model that the King County offers. Next slide. This is a comparison of the operational profile for the Sopani Police Department. That services the city of Snoqualmie itself. So the way Snoqualmie organizes its budget, there is a cost center for services to North Bend, as well as services that are provided to justice citizens of Snoqualmie. So in this case, services provided to citizens of Snoqualmie, 19.8 FTEs, 5.01 million, which is our expenses, that equates to an average cost per officer of about $250,000 or $345 per capita. And I highlighted here, and we've discussed this in previous meetings, that their figures there are about 30% less than the charging of the city of Northampton.
And you may have said this, I'm just looking at numbers trying to get this out. On ours, it says, like we're 14.25 police officers full time in 2025, and then it says cost per capita. Our number is a lot higher, it's 490.
That's exactly it.
So that's a function of the population. Councilwoman Torres said that there are 8,260 residents. And we divide the annual operating expenses of 25 or just over 4 million into 8,000 residents.
Okay.
Whereas for the other table, we have the operating cost of 5 million. Serving 14,000 residents. And that equates to an average cost per capita of $345.
Yeah. I don't like this very nice. Okay, sorry. It's
welcome. Councilwoman Westbrook.
Let's go.
Thank you. So just to clarify, these numbers are based on what we know from Mr. Palmy to date, but we have submitted a request for proposal from them, and so we might get back something different. So this is just based on what you know at this time, correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
In terms of the special proposal, that's a great segue into this next slide. What we have here are key dates for when the proposals are due. And on the original date, we have responses, written responses due on the 31st of March, with scored responses for the written portion on April 2nd. Verbal presentation to council on April 8th, and then a scoring of that presentation by April 13th, and then a tentative council decision making on Tuesday, May 6th. What we'll present to you here are a set of revised dates. Bob, would you like to speak to these dates?
Sure, thank you. The revised dates, I do apologize up front. I should have sent the organization council this morning an email. We received a request from Sequoia asking to move the deadline from the receipt of proposal to Friday, April 11th. They cited the difficulties with staffing resources to be able to put together a proposal to get ready for the presentation and be prepared to do that. And they said they thought a tight turnaround. But the mayor's anticipated granting that approval, but that necessitates us obviously moving the presentation date to something other than it looks like there's a council member to have conflict with April 22nd. We'd like to have all councilors in attendance. And so what we're proposing is potentially there's a fifth Tuesday, April 29th, that could possibly work with the council. By the way, we would obviously push it out into early May. But that would be the date that we would recommend rather than April 22nd.
Why wouldn't we make it April 15th?
I agree.
Yeah, we do.
Well, that would be a regular council meeting, right?
So let me ask, are we going to be doing calendars right now? Just
yes.
We have to.
Because yes. I'm not here on
the 15th. April 15th.
I'm obviously.
But you could do
We think we still meet the Tuesday, May 6th date for council to discuss the delivery. If we got on April 29th.
Doesn't city council, or doesn't that have to come to your committee?
That's council's preference. The discussions with the mayor and the mayor of town, there's a, since it's such a large factor in all your discussions and both your budget, it might be move the council to consider a committee of the whole. But that's up to the council, obviously. No. I would recommend.
Is there a way that we cannot speak with Snoqualmie and not have it moved to our original date?
We spoke to them yesterday. That's what they were.
And about. How does King County feel about this?
They were, when I notified them this morning, they said they didn't care. I don't think they had a conflict.
So is this typically what we do with RFP processing? If an agency or a vendor that's putting in for a proposal will move it, a deadline? If they can't make a deadline?
It's a request. I think it's fair and reasonable. I take full responsibility for not getting the RFP out. I would say that perhaps a week earlier, it should have been done. That would give them 3 weeks. Given under that circumstance, it's still similar to the type of that would go. You're asking for a 11-day extension.
Yeah, my concern is we're compressing, you know, the amount of time between the score presentation and the city approval, 10 days less is what we're doing. And that was one of, you know, we've talked about having enough time to discuss, absorb the stuff and really work through it. Is there a way we can, you know, either compress a little on the, you know, from the presentation, I guess we can't on the presentation, but some way to give a little bit, you know, somewhere in between?
Specifically after or before your plan?
Well, between the score presentation and the city council approval, that basically cuts down 10 days less for the council to debate and decide.
Well, can I throw out an idea to maybe with that?
Please.
If there are the proposals are moved written responses to the 11th, why don't we just have the presentation on the 8th and submit the written response after the presentation and you can score it in that time frame? I don't know what the written response score, why that would affect the presentation. You can have that score afterwards.
They're asking for the proposal to be submitted on the 11th. You're suggesting a presentation before that, though?
Well, they're working on the proposal. They can present that, and the written part can be due the following week, and we can score it in that time frame. But at least all of us will be here. Mm-hmm. And then both pieces are getting scored. For, you know, the presentation is being made, the written will get scored, and will follow the same timeline that we have.
I don't know if they'd be prepared to present before they have the proposal submitted. I don't.
Haven't they already been doing their proposal like at the public health and safety meetings? So they kind of are prepared.
They didn't have the formal proposal in their hand until late Friday, and we were for the session this past Monday, yesterday morning. So they did know the contents of what we were asking for. They could have been some type of preparation that would entail if they certainly didn't have the request for proposal in their hand at that time.
Is what we were asking unreasonable? We said, okay, we're going to put these metrics in that are going to come into the proposal so we can do apples to apples comparisons, provide everybody with the same information at the same time, same date. Was what we put in the RFP unreasonable?
Yeah, that's
what. That was in the RFP. Perhaps the time allotted to perform. We were expecting to give them about 3 weeks, and that's what happened.
And because we're up against the June clock, I think.
Yes. Well, we did notify Sequoia yesterday that if we're looking at pushing this out, we believe it would necessitate an extension of the ILA after May 31st.
If they agree to that, can we then move the Tuesday, May 6th out another week to give us more time? What was the next? The 20th. So we'd have to move it out to May 20th or have a special session specifically to it.
If because this date is not working for us, then they're not prepared do we have to speak to them, present if they're not prepared? I feel like this is when you're in school and you have to do your presentation. There's a deadline. You're not ready, you're not ready, you're going to get an F. Sorry. Am I wrong?
Are you proposing to just sort of response?
Yeah. Sure.
Can we do that? I wouldn't recommend it.
No. Mark.
Right, first of all, I apologize to the public for having a conversation about how to schedule council business in the public meeting. It's somewhat inappropriate, but we're trying. This is a really important decision. It's 25-30% of the city's budget. It's worth the time, effort, and energy we can give it. It's worth providing those few parties who are interested in offering the proposal to provide those services the best opportunity to bring the best foot forward and set aside past behaviors, past shortages of information, past perceptions on, how folks have been treated. We're moving forward with a new process to try and come up and be presented with the best information available to us to make the best decision that we can as a deliberative body. Towards that end, I'm supportive of getting some quality at the time that they have requested and working then as a council to schedule this. I've heard possibilities that things can be pushed out a little bit such that interested parties and members of this body can all be accommodated. Towards that end, I would ask a clarifying question to our council as to whose ultimate decision it is to schedule the presentation of RFPs to council. Is it a work study? Does it fall to council as a work study? Normally, council sets agendas for work studies, or because it's an RFP process, does that do we defer to the mayor?
It's a tough question. I hope you're satisfied with my answer. My answer is, so a request for proposal is through the executive branch. So the administration of a request for a proposal and the deadlines are set by the mayor or her designee in the executive branch. However, your work study agendas, that is set by the council. So what you hear at what night for a work study, that's going to be subject to the council's authority. So hopefully the two will match. But I look forward to your continued debate on the scheduling of your agenda.
Thank you.
That was clear as mud.
Are there more conversations?
Well, I have a clarifying question. Also, the date, May 6th, just to be clear, is for an item to come to council on the direction of how to pursue, not a contract. Right? So we need the time, executive branch needs the time to negotiate that contract. But so, Councilmember Elwood's point, we have, I believe, an outside date currently of June 1st. Is that just, am I accurate with that?
That's correct. So, the May 6th, just so I can clarify, that would be the date on which we would present an agenda bill to council for your consideration and deliberation on if you wanted that night to select a preferred candidate if you want to provide services for a vendor.
And in case it's helpful for me to clarify, the regular city council meeting agendas, so your first and third Tuesdays, those are set by your mayor in consultation with the mayor pro tem. But the mayor's agenda sets that agenda. It's the work study that I was responding to with your mayor pro tem's question.
And so, we need May 6th, and then because it's we have to reapprove it again in the following meeting, right before we can, or we only need one meeting to approve it.
I would anticipate if this following suggested a modified schedule, and you met at May 6th to contemplate, deliberate, discuss your preferred or your choice for police services, you provide direction that night to the mayor to authorize her and staff to negotiate an agreement with one of the two agencies.
Well,
whatever anybody else may be able to get back.
I have a question for Kendra. How do you decide whether this item has to come through committee or not? Whose decision is that?
I'd like to take a moment to look at your council rules, if I may. That being said, your council rules don't dictate if you prefer for it to come through work study, because it is a big part of the budget and it is an important matter for the city. There is nothing preventing me from just having it go to work study. I can look through the procedural mechanism, though. Generally, council can waive their rules. So if it generally goes through committee, you can waive it and have it just go to work study, should you desire to do so.
Yeah, one of the things I also noticed is we're talking about doing a SCORE presentation on Friday, which requires, is everybody available on that Friday? That's just staff. That's not the presentation. Okay.
Okay, so what are the dates that we need to be here?
I know, I'm super lucky.
Row 1 is not, we don't have to be here for row 1.
That's correct.
Right. Row 2, we don't have to be here for row 2, correct?
Correct.
Proposals to council, sounds like you need to be here for that one.
Yes.
SCORE presentation?
No.
No, and then council director. So we're really talking 2 meetings here, right?
Correct.
Thank you.
Good. I guess the question is when the council want to see the SCORE numbers before we make a decision? So we're going to have a proposal to the council.
Right.
You're going to score it, and then on May 6th, we're going to have to make a decision based upon what you send to us in the SCORE. That's we're kind of compressing that really tight and not giving any opportunity either to have multiple meetings to discuss this. This is, you know, again, 30% of our budget. And as we've seen, we've had a lot of discussion about this all, you know, as we go through. Once we get the proposals, I would assume there's going to be even more discussion back and forth. And so that, again, gives me concern that we're compressing pressing everything 10 days, and to the point, you know, it'd probably be easier to you know, if we can get moved a little bit on the deadline and move things down to be able to give this council proper amount of time to review this document and make this decision.
Mark.
Propose something, I guess. And we're officially taking no action, just to be clear. At some point, we're going to say we move past this agenda item to what's next. There's going to be a vote, there's going to be an agenda bill, the parents are going to announce their decision as to when the RFPs will be due. We're going to decide to stop asking questions. But from what I'm hearing, we're prioritizing getting some of that honoring the request, which pushes it out, the presentation out to, near as I can tell, the 29th of April, because council isn't available at what would be regularly the scheduled time once we start talking about randomly hitting dates off. So once that's the 29th, to accommodate concerns about time and giving this its due, then everything else has to get pushed out. I've heard the option of extending the existing ILA with some quality, which takes staff time in all cities. It's unfortunate, but it's possible. We could then move the May 6th date, which requires council, back 2 weeks to May 20th. And if that happens, I think most parties would be, apart from it getting pushed down the road and extra staff resources being spent to accommodate that, I think it would accommodate the need for the voices and interested parties to participate in a way that is honoring of the need to get it right.
I don't necessarily disagree. We have no idea what an extension would be on June 1st process. That is a fully negotiated amendment. Has not even been discussed.
Yeah, that was my question, is what are the contingencies here on that? Because we say, yeah, you can deal with it, but then we get to the deadline, and if the problem decides, no, it's not going to do it. Now, I'd like to think in the best interest of preserving the relationship, it would allow and be supportive of the extension, but really, what evidence do we have that that's actually what's going to happen? So I don't know what to propose on that. Then a good handshake with the neighboring community and say, okay, we extend these deadlines. We'll come up and we need to push the extension. We'll push the extension. We'll work on that together.
Well, Brandon, part of my job and thank you all for supporting me in this is to build this relationship. And you all like to do that. And I'm intending and have the potential to do that. And I appreciate the work as for us to have these things. But yeah, there's no guarantee.
but it's my intent. So there's a risk there.
Because it almost seems to me like there's another round of conversations with Paul. Yeah.
Well, I think Bob and I, and hopefully see Sapone will accommodate, have multiple meetings, maybe whatever we can do. I hope Sapone would be able to understand and go forward in that direction. Bob, I think he would understand it as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, question, do we need to, if we have to push all this back, have to negotiate another month of whatever our service fee is going to be, and get that signed before we go forward? Is that the order of events to make sure that we're all reached?
Otherwise, I believe it's getting worse. I believe that's right.
Yeah, that's correct. I just checked with the city attorney. We would need to
get a jump on that.
Okay, so the follow-up question, sorry. And in doing that, now we need to look at a calendar event too, because then we have to have our meetings and we have to approve the, then we have to approve that. So then, how does that affect our calendar?
I can answer. The legal question is, it's an interlocal government agreement, so the council, everybody does have to approve it. So any extension would have to be approved by council.
Which means another meeting.
Or two.
So what do we do right now, in this moment, so we can move forward?
I got a suggestion. I think we have given our concerns to the administration. I think they need to go back and take our concerns and figure out what they can do to try to help us with our concerns. I don't think we could solve it tonight, and I think we're taking a lot of this body's time and other people's time to decide this. And you know, I think they're trying to do what's right, and I think we have to trust the administration to give us some timelines.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Alan. One more
addition,
sort of.
So, in doing that, should we have a consensus like the 29th is good for all of us? And just say that and then send it off to you guys to?
That would be the key date that we could gain some consensus council on the April 29th and the possibility that would help us to then control the other dates.
Yeah, but I think you need to tell us what the financial impact of moving it to April 29th is going to be. That's paramount.
I also think we would hope that Snohomie would work with us because they're the ones asking for it. And the mayor has been working on that relationship along with our city administrator.
Well, there's always a risk, Alan.
There always is, but I'm hoping. I'm trying to be positive on
it. I appreciate that. Thank you.
And we need to make sure that the 29th would work for King County as well.
Yes.
Appreciate
it. Sorry.
Thank you for that, everybody. Don't you all? Just to get the level of your. Okay, we're going to move right on to commission committee reports. Brendan, take
the lead
for us.
Thank you, Your Honor. CED met today at 4 o'clock at the City Hall of German Room.
Thank you.
This year we discussed Mountain View Townhome developer agreements. We discussed another agreement, but an exclusive negotiation agreement with NW Northwest Contracting or Consulting Firm. We discussed middle housing impact fee analysis. We had an introduction on that. That was still moving forward, which is great. We also kind of had a debrief on the shoreline access and trail plan after the heavily attended event that sat down on February 26th, I think it was. And then we had another discussion on King County Grant Contract Amendment for Meadowbrook Farm Prairie Loop. It's a $500,000 grant fund, which is great. And then also discussion and recommendations put forward to council for a professional services agreement with contractor for that, consultant for that. And the next meeting is April 15th, 4 o'clock in the evening.
Mr. Elwood, we're going to Alan Kautel for Finance Administration.
Thank you very much. Well, the Finance Administration Committee met March 11th at 4 o'clock in the City Adjournment Room. I want to thank Martin. We had a discussion of the 2025 budget book and review of that. Really like the way that looks. Resolution to surplus miscellaneous office furniture. We also discussed motion authorizing and approve purchase of office and conference room furniture for the new conference room that we're setting up to add more room here. And then resolution to amend rules of procedure for council meetings and a committee discussion on that. And just status of various department initiatives were discussed. The annual auditor, the impact fee update, tax increment financing, utility rate update, and Meadowbrook. And was amazed with all that. It was put together so well that we actually made it in the background. So thank you, Martin, for all your work.
Thank you, Recess Rustic, Public Health and Safety.
Thank you. Public Health and Safety met March 4th and at 4 o'clock in the adjournment room. We received a fire update from Eastside Fire and Rescue. I reviewed the February 2025 chief briefing and the February 2025 incident history, as well as an update on some staffing and retirements. We also received a police update, talked about the February 2025 department briefing and their ongoing evidence room update. Oh, and I missed on the fire update at the April 1st public health and safety meeting. We will have our guest Kat Robinson with Wildlife Fire Mitigation Specialist to present to the Public Health and Safety Committee. So we're looking forward to that. We discussed the Sunnyside Jail contract and the Yakima Jail contract, both of which were in the agenda packet for tonight. And then just one final note, we discussed placing on next month's agenda, the council has received a number of communications from the public about e-bikes, golf carts, and ATVs on city streets, so we had already discussed putting that on the agenda for the April 1st public health and safety meeting. So just want to let you all know. That's it.
Thank you very much, Nicole, and Transportation Public Works.
Thank you, Mayor. We had Transportation and Public Works. We had a full agenda as usual on February 25th, 2025, at 4 p.m. here. The first item was motion approving a contract with PSC associated with 2024 sidewalk calves. The second thing was resolution approving the Harrison Court Tree Farm final plat. We were provided a map of the planned 2025 and 2026 construction sidewalks transportation. We talked about policy discussion on when to use rectangular rapid flashing beacons, because we don't want to use too many, but we want to have enough and keep everybody safe. We talked about the resolution approving Fourth Amendment to lease agreement for the Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife. We talked about discussion regarding the request for city to vacate a skinny ROW near Northwest 8th Street. The agenda has not been prepared, but we are working on it. We made a motion authorizing the purchase of a man lift facilities, which is on our agenda tonight, that we will all get to discuss. Which is basically a charity fair to help hang lights and tree work and all the things our city workers need to do. We made a motion authorizing amendment number one to work order with Keithley Electric for emergency management. And Don Marasinko, a resolution awarding construction contract to contractor XYZ for SR 202 sidewalk improvement transportation. Finally, a discussion on South Fork Avenue Extension Project. That is your honor.
Thank you very much, Mayor Pro Tem Mark Johnson, work study.
Thank you, Your Honor. Council met in work study in the adjournment room of City Hall on February 25th. On the agenda was revisiting and a debrief on the retreat held by council in February. I do note that the final report was sent out, I believe, earlier today. We discussed the 2025 work study calendar, and then in conversation around the request for proposal process and metrics for police services contracts, which we explained to the priority hearing tonight. Talking about that specific. Thank you, Your
Honor. Thank you. Moving on, Mr. Henderson, planning first, and I
have to go
with commission reports, please.
Yes, good evening, Mayor and Council members. The planning commission last met on February 19th at that meeting, Northport Development LLC. The proponent for development of vacant property just north of Travel Centers of America at 1834 provided a neighborhood public meeting consistent with the requirements in the city's master plan regulations in the North Bay Municipal Code Chapter 13. The Planning Commission also held a public hearing and provided a recommendation of approval to Council for a proposed development agreement with PJO Northwest Development for a horizontal mixed-use project that proposes 65 townhomes and 8,000 square feet of commercial building space along Southeast North End Way next to Todd's Tony. The DA is proposed to allow the project to contain ground floor residential behind the commercial buildings that would front North End Way, as ground floor residential not otherwise permitted within the neighborhood mixed-use zone in which the proposal is located. The Planning Commission next meets tomorrow, by evening, March 19th, and will hold a public hearing and deliberate on minor amendments to the city's critical area regulations and critical areas mapping. The amendments are provided consistent with the recommendations from the city's critical areas consultant prepared during the city's 2024 comprehensive plan update to ensure consistency with the best available science. They include updated references to current critical area mapping and delineation and mitigation guidance provided by federal and state agencies and associated minor updates to the city's critical area map series. The updates do not include revisions to buffers. The Parks Commission met last on February 26th and those two back-to-back workshops involving park and trail topics. The first workshop was an open house on the city's shoreline employee access trail plan, being prepared to plan for trail and access opportunities along the South and Middle Forks and Pauline Rivers within city limits. The second workshop was to present the conceptual design of the new public plaza at the terminus of Ballarat Avenue between North Bend Bar and Grill and the Shell Station. Both workshops were very well attended and provided good feedback to the staff and the consultant preparing these plans. The Parks Commission next meets on March 26th, which will be a joint meeting of the Parks Commission and the Economic Development Commission to discuss scoping, schedule, and the public outreach plan for the city's planned bicycle mobility plan. Finally, the Economic Development Commission met on February 27th and selected Michael Coons, position 4, as the chair, and Nick Jensen, position 1, as the vice chair. The commission also discussed expanding Metro Trailhead direct passenger bus system to include stops at art venues across North Bend to encourage visitors to patronize local artisans, arts and crafts fair, and performances. Commissioner Burroughs announced that her consultants will be doing a site visit with elected officials and representatives sometime between March 25th and 26th for the proposed Art Village project. The commission will meet in about 2 weeks to discuss market ideas for the upcoming World Cup in 2026.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Gautel.
Eastside Fire and Rescue.
Thank you. Eastside Fire and Rescue met at a regular agenda meeting March 13th at 4 p.m. at the headquarters. We had a special recognition of our new core program manager, Tori McBride. We also had a staff report on write-offs. We also got a presentation from our agency on a group that was putting together new mission, vision, and values, which was pretty good. We also had a long-term policy ad hoc committee to discussion of forming that so that we can talk about long-term financial policies and what we can do moving forward. We also had a report and approved under the fire chief ad hoc update committee employing GMP as our recruiting agency to help us recruit for a new fire chief. The other one I thought was kind of interesting, we also surplused a Ford F-150 that was in a part of our apparatus that was in an accident, and it was basically totaled by the insurance, picked it up for $3,000 and picked it apart, and were able to save a lot of money on maintaining another agency. So we replaced the doors on one. Another one got hit on the back end, so we actually took the back end off of the F-150 and put it to repair the other one, so very well done. During the chief's briefing, he discussed, No pressure at all. But during the chief's briefing, he reviewed timelines for his, ending his with the agency and helping out. And then we discussed a little bit more about what things we need to do moving forward on the ad hoc committee. And there was a discussion on fee for transport during that conversation.
Thank you very much.
We're going to move on to the committee, original committees. Anybody in the council have anything to come up? SCA PIC committee met on March 12th. Two major topics we discussed. First was on a growth fund request and the growth management planning council is going to make a decision. And so only Incarnation request to reduce their growth management targets from 1,500 to 719, respectively, and for Snoqualmie and Incarnation from 799 to 350. They went through the reconciliation process, and a decision will be made upcoming, I believe it is in May. Some of the reasons given were water supply, the floodplain in downtown Snoqualmie, limited development potential. Carnation took issue with the Polk Dam emergency route, the size of their total land area of the city itself, as well as the infrastructure having one road in and out. So, pretty interesting discussion. I think the SCA position was that they would support the reconciliation and adjust specifically for this update and not to create a precedent to reduce housing needs, but it is up to GMPC to make that decision. So we will see how that decision goes. Secondly, we had a lengthy and robust discussion about the King County Parks levy upcoming. Director John Taylor was there presenting on behalf of the Department of Natural Resources and Parks. A fairly thorough presentation discussed a number of the items that are included in this levy. It's a 6-year, approximately $1.5 billion across King County. A lot of discussion around how much money we're actually going to cities specifically. Some good conversation from our friends Incarnation and myself around taking a hard look at regionalization and how, for example, some of the Incarnation would come out to North Bend if some of those funds were funneled here and vice versa, and maybe take a hard look at specific, instead of city-specific, population-specific, and how that money is going to spread across King County. There was a number of items, opportunities, I should say, for grants, specifically for aquatic facilities. We discussed the regional approach to identify some of those funds for an east side aquatics facility, which we are well aware of and we've been discussing at this council. So I think there's some promising opportunities ahead. It's a big levy, a lot of discussion, certainly not a consensus on whether cities within SCA were overly supportive, but it's got a long road ahead. But that's about it. There should be some follow-up discussion and details based on the SCA group's concerns about how the levy is being presented, and we will share those as we get them.
Mr. Tremola, and in fact, thank you for all the thorough conversation. I appreciate it. Thank you, everybody. Okay, on to you, Susan.
May I?
Sorry, did I miss you? Okay, hurry back.
I just wanted to share that the King County Affordable Housing Committee met on March 6th and did a review of the affordable housing plan for Skokomish, which is a very small city in King County, reviewed the work plan of 2025 and talked about strategic direction as we move forward.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me to meet four eyes.
That's okay.
Okay. All right, so the SDA, Sound Cities Association of Regional Law, Safety, and Justice Committee met on February 27th. The topic was federal immigration impacts and King County response, as well as U-Visa and T-Visa program, which I never heard of that before this meeting. Federal immigration impacts and King County response. There was a panel discussion. We had King County Councilmember Haywood Barone, Director Monisha Harrell from the King County Executive Office, and Undersheriff Jesse Anderson from King County Sheriff's Office. So the policies, none of these do not inquire about citizenship or immigration status in routine interactions or at community events. No enforcement or support provided for civil immigration matters, including ICE detainers or warrants not signed by judges. That's an important point right there. Sheriff's Office does not participate in criminal investigations with federal agencies such as FBI, DEA, and ATF, but has limited interaction with ICE. No cooperation with federal immigration enforcement unless a criminal warrant exists. Sheriff's Office may provide public safety support in case of civil disturbances related to immigration issues. The Superior Court concerns about immigration enforcement have to do with the fear of ICE activity near courthouses may deter individuals from seeking protective protection orders, testifying, or participating in the legal system. Washington State law, though, has established a 1 mile protective zone around courthouses. And then the other issue was handling criminal warrants for undocumented individuals. King County enforces criminal warrants regardless of immigration status. Individuals wanted for serious crimes such as rape, murder, child trafficking are subject to extradition and arrest procedures. There has to be a warrant. Then the other topic was public perception versus policy direction. There was a poll done and 51% supporting, statewide, 51% supporting federal deportation plans, 40% opposed. And then King County was 48% supported cooperation, 39% opposed. And then Mayor Zimmerman, he noted that there's a disconnection between public sentiment and policy direction, and we also have a concern about what does sanctuary state mean in Washington. And also, King County Councilmember Baymore Barone stated that he is concerned about Washington State being called a sanctuary state, as it gives the impression that criminal immigrants can stay here without consequence. They talked about a couple of different cities having information on their website. Then I went on to U Visa and T Visa program presentations. But now, this was interesting because I'd never heard this before. What it is the purpose of it is to protect immigrant victims of serious crimes. It encourages reporting of crimes and cooperation with law enforcement and strengthens community safety and builds trust between illegal immigrants, communities, and law enforcement. And basically, the King County Sheriff's Office role is to determine eligibility for UNT visa certifications, but they do not issue the visas. It just takes the report. So a U visa is for victims of crimes such as domestic violence, assault, sexual abuse, trafficking. T visas are for victims of severe human trafficking who cooperate with investigations. So basically that allows them to stay in the States when they get these visas. The certification process, even if no arrest charges or conviction occurs, law enforcement can still certify the assistance from victim to support visa applications. Then one concern was raised that potential abuse of the visa system and protections for falsely accusing U.S. citizens. And then the King County Ordinance 19892 updates to the immigration policies that happened. They updated the King County Code to align with Washington State's Keep Washington Working Act from 2019. It eliminates requirement for county jail officials to collect and report nationality information to immigrant authorities, prohibits county participation in civil immigration enforcement except where mandated by law. ICE detainers requested will not be honored unless accompanied by a judicial criminal warrant. and that it's ICE access to detainees without proper authorization. And that's pretty much what we talked about.
Okay.
That's
about ours. Very thorough, thank you. Anybody else like to bring this? No? Okay, let's Acting Chief Bracy. Way back there. Thank you. Would you mind putting us on, please? Please. Thank you.
Good evening. So I'm going to kind of cover some stuff. Y'all have our monthly report from February to show just kind of the culture charts between the two cities and our response times, things like that. So I'll quickly hit on, I kind of compared January to February of this year so far. Culture service for both cities went down. 550 for Snoqualmie to 431 for January, February, and North Bend was 460 to 409. Our priority one response, that's those that involve weapons, domestic violence, assaults, burglaries in progress, motor vehicle collisions where there's injuries, things like that, blocking roads that we will respond to. Our response times in January were for North Bend, 2 minutes and 29 seconds. For Snoqualmie, 2 minutes and 54 seconds. And in for February, North Bend was 2 minutes and 13 seconds. And Snoqualmie, 2 minutes. So, looking at thefts across the board, they kind of swap, actually, from January to February. You'll see in January, Snoqualmie had 6, and that went up to 8 in February. North Bend was 9 and went down to 5. And then vehicle prowls went down for North Bend from 301. So January there were 3, 4, or in February there was only 1 that was reported. And then vehicle thefts, we actually had a little bit of an increase, and I'll get into that here in just a second. But there were 6 in North Bend for February, and then 3 in January of this year. For February, we had a total of arrests for Snoqualmie, 5 and 16 in North Bend. And then our crisis intervention contacts, this is when the officers are making contact with somebody. Mind you, on February 5th, our mental health professional left our department. So the officers have been taking up that slack and using outside resources and those contacts that she had and applying them to our community. Those contacts, we had 3 in North Bend and 1 in Snoqualmie. With that said, we also worked with Friends of the Trail during this time frame, and they had made contact with some of the transient population in homeless camps and started helping provide them resources and cleaning up, so that's going to be included in that number as well. And then we had, so far year to date, we're at 98 public disclosure requests and 54 for 2025. At the last meeting, I asked about breaking those up. I asked my staff, and there's a lot of factors that go into those public disclosure requests. It could be on an officer, it could be on training, it could be on a call or a particular case, and it's really hard to break those up based on the cities. So that's kind of why we're sticking with that number. And then on my staffing levels, it kind of rolls into March a little bit, but we were in February, we were only down one spot in patrol, and we were fully staffed as of March with the hire of who will be our future SRO, who is currently in training. He started last week. So we had in community events, we've had our part of the North Penn Citizens Academy that rolled into March, but there was a lot of preparation into that going into coming in from February. And then we were supposed to have the career fair at the high school, which was going to be in February, but that got moved, and that's actually this coming Friday. So I'll kind of cover some of the things that we saw this year in February as far as calls for service that were kind of the bigger ones or major incidents. We did have a robbery at Truck County. The suspect fled. This happened at the TA. During the course of this almost month since that happened. We're actually kind of closing in. Hopefully we'll have a suspect identified soon through a lot of legwork and investigative work and partnership with other agencies. So I'm hoping to have a resolution to that where we can file charges on that person sooner than later, but it is still a work in progress. We also had a fire at the train depot, which I think most everybody's aware of. That was a known subject to us who was transient and lit a fire on the stairs, and the officers saw it, went in, had fire come in. They ended up actually charging the individual with arson. That after the arrest, he was transported to the hospital. He assaulted one of the officers, so he got charged with assault, and he was booked into county, along with obstruction and criminal trespass, as he was also trespassed from that property from previous incidents. We did have a truck hit a pole downtown in front of Sure Shot. The Public Works immediately took care of that as soon as we got notification to them in the next day. We had a couple DUI arrests, excessive speeds, and then I'm sure everybody's aware of the Downtown Business Foundation incident where there was fraud. I suggested, during the committee meeting that, everybody pay attention to what type of credit card systems they're using, things like that, and just monitor and have extra security systems, built into your firewalls and things like that. We're still working that case. It's not going to be a quick case to solve. There's a lot of warrant writing for that to determine IP addresses and try to locate people, but I can assure you we are constantly working on that case. Outlet mall activity. We had two thefts from Nike, a theft from Levi's, a theft from Sunglass Hut, and this one's a little weird. This one kind of rolls into the reason the vehicle thefts were up. There was a vehicle stolen from Tanner Electric that was then driven to the North Bend outlet where they attempted to steal the ATM. That attempted theft, I say attempted because it was interrupted. They then fled, dumped the truck over at the Safeway pumps, and they stole two other vehicles and left the area, and those vehicles were recovered later that day in Southland County. So those three kind of don't bring those numbers up a little bit. It's a circumstantial thing, but they were recovered and returned to the owners. As Council Member Rustic stated, we are also undergoing a construction project at the PD that I hope actually wraps up later this week or early next week. Once that's done, I'll probably have an invite to know if y'all want to come by and see kind of some of the work that we've been doing. So that's kind of my update for the month of February. I'll have stats for you and everything as usual for the month of March. Shortly after the first week of April. Any questions?
And I know it was explained to me before, I just honestly I can't remember. When I look at crisis intervention, thank you for the update, very thorough, I appreciate that. The crisis intervention contacts, the February year to date was a pretty hefty number. Miss Apalmi, 55, and then this year, one. Is that one person?
So that could be a couple different people, one contact.
Okay.
One of the reasons that you're going to see more in the 2024 when we're comparing is, especially compared to right now, really late September through now, is our mental health professional was out for maternity leave, and then she came back for a very short time and then decided to spend time with her family and depart the city. So those numbers are going to be different because she was heavily involved during that time frame in carrying her own caseload and doing follow-up with those who she had already established. So you will see a bigger difference between those numbers simply because she was out there doing what her job was, and now it's just when we get followed or we contact somebody, things like that. So it's on top of her. The 2024 is also her workload plus the officers.
Okay.
Okay, because that was my next question. It wasn't just a couple of people. Is it because we're down our mental health expert?
That's part of it. And we have opened that position up, and I hope to get it filled sooner than later, obviously. There's the application process is still currently open.
Yeah, just to follow on. So with those numbers, you know, we don't have a mental health professional. Were those contacts or those calls for those contacts still maybe covered in a different metric? Like, because you were saying that your officers right now.
So right now it's the officers that are making those contacts, where before it was kind of a combination of both. We also, in previous...
It would be like a priority 3 call, potentially.
Potentially, or it could be a priority 1 call where somebody was there and then, you know, they're suffering from mental health. For instance, the arson, that one is also kind of classified as a crisis call because that person was in crisis. The little building fire, and there were a lot of issues in that. I can't kind of comment on that because it's an active investigation still, or it's still processing through being done.
Right, I guess I was just saying on metric. We still have the crisis call, we're just being
yes.
Like police officers.
Yes.
We're not going to see that.
But yes. So you're not going to see what the mental health professional caseload would be. We used to break that out in previous forms, but because she's not there, you won't see the breakout. They're kind of combined now until we get that position back.
Thank you, Rabbi.
I'll be back
in a moment. All right, we're ready to roll on to introductions. Item number 11.
Excuse me, Mayor. Who is perhaps taking a short break for a
sure.
Special? Is that okay or not?
Absolutely. Yeah. Take a
5-minute
break.
So
yes. Okay, thank you, everybody.
Recording stopped.
Anyone who's online with us tonight, appreciate your being here as well. Okay, moving on to introductions. Item number 11, AB25-020, ordinance amending NB's NC chapters 18.06-18.1 and 18.30 relating to accessory dwelling units. Ms. Templin, would you please provide your number tonight?
Good evening, everybody. It's a pleasure to see you all this fine evening. I'm here to present to you proposed amendments to the zoning code regarding accessory dwelling units. Proposed changes are meant to address requirements under the Growth Management Act, specifically House Bill 1337, requiring essentially a relaxation of local city standards regarding design, development standards, permitting, and permitted use allowances for accessory dwelling units. There are some additional components to amendments that are more best practice recommendations for your consideration as well. And I look forward to answering any questions or concerns that you may have here tonight.
Thank you very much. If any members of the audience would like to comment on this agenda item tonight, we invite you to come forward to the podium at this time. If you have a request accommodation with the city clerk, you wish to speak, please raise your hand to the virtual platform. And we'll take your comments out of in the person comment. Please remember to state your name, your address, and 3 minutes for registering. And welcome, Kate.
Hi, Kate Lean, 980 Boulevard Southeast. I'd like to comment in favor of this ordinance. As Ms. Hepworth mentioned, this obviously fulfills a lot of requirements that you have for the Growth Management Act, and specifically that a certain percentage must be used for low-income housing. This is a great way for the city to provide us in areas that are already developed for residential use, which will minimize the environmental impact. And it would allow property owners to develop their own properties in the way that they choose, with potential income sources that could flow from that as well. Why this type of housing is needed is really for two groups that are underserved in our housing market right now. We have a son that is going to graduate from high school this year and go to trade school, and we would very much like him to be able, if he chose, to come back here to start his career without living in our house. I think that's cool of most parents. The census actually keeps data on this, and I looked it up for King County, 21% of 18 to 20, 34-year-olds live at home with a parent. In our area, in the school district, that number is 38%. So I'll let that sink in. Over a third of our young adults are living with their parents right now that live in this area. The other population that this serves is seniors. We watched a great documentary film called No Place to Grow Old recently, which talks about the senior housing crisis. They worked with the Joint Center for Housing Studies, which talked about the population of seniors rising in the last decade, specifically in rural areas. Older adults who are cost burdened is at an all-time high. Renters age 62 and over who are eligible for rental assistance has increased 50% since 2011. They specifically need accessible housing, which means single story, no step entry, and wide doorways, which is a natural fit for ADUs. So what I'd really like to see the city discuss is the possibility of how you can encourage this specific kind of development around ADUs when you're talking about policies and codes that will happen after this. So perhaps prioritizing grants for people that are willing to have those accessible features. Grants for homeowners who are willing to build one and then commit to leasing it out for a certain number of years. Discounts on impact fees for utility hookups if they're close to a transportation line, close to a sewer line, near the downtown core. And then grants or subsidies, perhaps even for keeping the rental rate below market value. So I'd love to see you treat homeowners as if they are developers and develop a property or a development agreement in some ways with them to help develop the kind of housing that you really want to have here. So I'm looking forward to hearing more about that discussion in the future, and thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. Anybody else? And I apologize, I jumped away from Caitlin. We should have some more conversation at council, so my apologies. I'm a wee bit tired, but I really appreciate everybody's effort to stay awake with me. So back to you.
If possible, I would like to add a couple of notes before I open the floor for discussion. First off, I just want to clarify that the Department of Commerce has reviewed all of our draft regulations regarding ADUs. It does support them as fully in conformance with House Bill 1337. Secondly, I want to acknowledge a small change in language to one specific section that staff discussed after a question from Commissioner Rustic was submitted. We wanted to add further clarification regarding front yard setback standards, ensuring that we are prohibiting ADUs in the front yard setback for detached units specifically. Attached units have to also meet underlying zoning standards in terms of bulk and dimensional requirements, which include setbacks. We just adjusted the language under North Bend Municipal Code 18.10.050, section 1, subsection 1.52F2. Detached EU shall meet the bulk and dimensional standards of the principal unit and maintain a minimum 5-foot side yard setback and 10-foot rear yard setback.
Can you say that again?
Sure. It should be Exhibit A. It is Section 18.10.050, Section 1, Residential Subsection 1.52, F2. It's within the table section.
Okay.
And the change is specifically highlighted since it is differing from the agenda packet that was circulated last week. Anything else?
Do you approximate how many requests or for ADU construction we get on any average year in North Bend in the last year or two?
I believe staff have iterated to me that it's about 3 to 4 per year, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's about right. It varies.
Okay, and then also, just to be clear, nothing about this would supersede any CCNR or HOA regulations. Those would still be paramount to specific communities. around town.
That is correct. Any existing HOA with a prohibition written into their CC&Rs prohibiting any development of ADU is allowed to continue as grandfathered in. Any new HOAs that are established will not be permitted to prohibit ADUs.
Thank you.
Anybody else?
Yes, as you mentioned, I have a number of questions for you, and to be clear, I am definitely in favor of affordable housing. My concerns were more centered around the increased fire danger with increased density, and then also any kind of traffic and parking concerns. And so can you touch on that just a bit on how the changes here do actually address that?
Sure, so I'll start with your parking concerns first. So there's not a change proposed for a parking code regarding accessory dwelling units. Accessory dwelling units are required to provide one on-site parking stall. So that is in addition, it stacks with any parking requirements of the existing or principal residential unit on-site. So a single family home is required to provide two paved parking stalls for the unit, and the ADU would be required to have one separate parking stall. These all have to be provided on site and not on the street, so when an applicant submits for a building permit, they will need to document with the city that they are able to provide that on site without exceeding any open dimensional standards. So, for example, impervious surface may limit a property's ability to develop an ADU simply because they cannot add any additional impervious surface to the parking area. We would, in that case, not be able to approve a building permit for that kind of project. As it relates to traffic, the city is currently evaluating impact fee changes, which would potentially consider changes to how we assess impact fees for ADUs. That is being handled separately and will also need to be adopted by the end of June in accordance with the Growth Management Act development regulation deadlines. With regard to your concern regarding buyer separation, that may be a better question to ask the building department. However, I know enough about the International Building Code to speak a little bit to it. With regards to detached ADUs and minimum separation requirements from the principal residential unit, I believe the building code or the fire code requires a minimum separation distance when there's no firewall grading wall provided in between those units. I believe that separation distance is typically a minimum of 5 feet.
Can I ask a follow-up, or you can move it? So just one follow-up. Thank you for your responses. They were very thorough, and I appreciated that. If we do approve an ADU, what means do we have to ensure that that the owners build it according to what's been stipulated?
Yeah.
Enforcement.
Anyone that's proposing an ADU on their property will have to go through a building permit process. That involves inspections after the permit is issued. So staff, including building department staff and planning staff, would probably go out to the site and verify that the ADU was constructed in a manner that reflects what was submitted to the city. If not, then that will become a code enforcement issue, and we would not be able to issue a certificate of occupancy for that building. So we would hold property owners accountable to build what they submit when they submit for their building permits.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Questions?
I'm sorry, you said there's going to be an amendment, and I guess I'm not understanding the amendment. I think before, there wasn't a rule about having an ADU in front of the house, and we're adding an amendment to not have that. I'm just confused.
Sure. So in the original copy of the City Council agenda packet, we had a section, F2, that simply stated that you needed to meet minimum side yard and rear yard setbacks. Mm-hmm. This change that was circulated to you for this meeting today basically iterates that ADU, detached ADUs cannot be placed in the front yard setback. It was never staff's intention to allow this. It shouldn't be different than what was previously allowed under our old code. Rather, it's meant to provide more consistency and clarity for developers.
Okay, I guess I didn't get that up to the document. Have we ever had anybody wanting more in front of their house?
Not that aware of.
Okay.
I've only been here 2 months, I'm not sure. what I can say though is that with attached ADUs, in terms of placement in the front yard, you may only see that if it's stacked on top of a garage or if it's truly attached to the existing residential building. Again, they're still not allowed to be placed in the front yard setback. The primary residential use should be conforming to that standard. However, there may be a rare instance, as described in the changes for the non-conforming use section in proposed amendments, that would cover situations like this, where there is perhaps a non-conforming residential building that does not meet current zoning standards, but once met old zoning standards. Mm-hmm. In which case, an ADU that's attached could hypothetically be placed within the front yard setback. Again, it would probably look like a unit that's above an existing garage.
Okay. So here's an example. You have a house, and let's say your setback is, I don't know, 40 feet from the front of your front line. And then you decide to have an ADU off the side of your house that protrudes out about 15 feet. Is that considered being in front of the house, or?
If I understand your hypothetical situation correctly, you're saying that there could be a situation in which there is a residential property with a 40-foot front yard setback, and the ADU is placed outside of that setback, but near it, or it protrudes 15 feet into the 40-foot setback.
So
that would not
essentially it's in front of the house, but off the side.
That would be prohibited if it's an attached ADU. If it's something that's being, if it's an attached part of the house and it's being simply retrofitted to accommodate an ADU internally, that would be a situation in which we would allow it as a non-conforming use.
If I can add, the key distinction there is front yard setback versus general front yard. So it could be in the general front yard area as long as it's outside of the front yard setback.
Okay, and the front yard setback is?
Generally 20 feet.
20 feet from the front line. Mm-hmm. Okay, but if it's back, then it would be okay. I can see there's some big properties out there that might, I mean, look good or would be okay. I just don't want to not allow them to be able to build. So I think ADUs is awesome, and the more opportunity to build ADUs, I would want to encourage. For all the reasons she just said, I mean, there's so many reasons for having ADUs, I just don't want to limit anybody who might be a great opportunity for them to have an ADU. Because that's the way their land is, you know, maybe their setback is, maybe their house is really towards the back end of the property. It'd be nice if they could have more of them. So, that's more kind of questioning it.
Okay, Council Member Elwood, would you please make a motion?
Motion to approve AB 25-020, an ordinance amending North Bend Municipal Code Chapters 18.06, 18.10, and 18.30, relating to accessory dwelling units, ADUs, as a first and final reading.
Thank you. Do I have a second?
Second.
Okay. My motion made by Mr. Elwood, and second by Mr. Delton. How would you like to speak to your motion?
Thank you for the introduction. To me, a big part of this is just following the law, so I kind of have to go in the law. And this has, just for the benefit of those here tonight, we have a committee called the Community Economic Development Committee, and we do bounce these ideas quite a bit, and so you're welcome to attend those. And this is a hot topic of discussion for us as we're trying to figure out how to improve our housing inventory for those in need within the city of North Bend. So I promise you it's an active conversation. And that's all I will have. Thank you.
Thank you. And Scott, I'll do it. Yeah.
All he said, plus the fact that it is a great way to provide additional housing, hopefully, you know, for those kids that need to stay around.
Anyone, any council additional comments from
Commissioner Mott? Yeah, I would just echo part of the discussion around this affordable housing, and that is a steep mountain to climb. And, but I think chipping away at it through ADUs, whether it's your child or a friend of a child or any person who moves into town and wants to a one bedroom, more supply like this, I think actually gets the crux of affordable housing. Big projects that we're working on are great, but they're a long time coming, slow moving. This could really unleash some real time opportunities for folks in the area.
Anybody else?
I have a question. I'm wondering, is what we're about to vote on including that amendment for the, or is that an additional motion?
It's part of
it. It should all be part of the same amendment package.
Yeah.
So the revision that was submitted, it just shows the change in language to one specific subsection.
All right, so my comment then is I would not vote for this because I don't want people to not be able to build in front of their homes an ADU when that's the way their property is. I want us to have ADUs, and I want citizens of North Bend to be able to build as many as they can within the parameters, but I feel like that particular addition will limit. Like, for example, my house, if I wanted to build an ADU, that's the place where I would put it, would be in front, because my property lines up in the back of my property line. So now it's basically eliminating me from building an ADU in the front there. So that's where. So,
maybe if I can answer that, just to clarify, you live in the ADR, or well, now you're in the downtown commercial zone. Right? So that's got to be a smaller front setback, depending on what the primary use is. So it's just that front setback that it can't be in. But for example, your house sits quite a way back in the yard. Mm-hmm. You could still place an ADU in front of your house as long as that ADU is outside of that smaller front setback.
I don't think I'm following.
So if you have a front yard setback of 10 feet and your home is set back from the property line 30 feet, you still have 15 feet of room in the front yard of your home to build that ADU. You just can't build it within that first 15 feet between your front property line and where that 15 foot line would be drawn horizontally across your property.
Okay. Can I ask
you? Yeah.
And let's say your first house wasn't there, we would still have a setback, wouldn't we? Mm-hmm. So the setback isn't something that new, it's just adhering to what's already there and making sure that it's called out in the document itself specifically. Does that make sense?
Well,
am I representing that right?
Yes. My brother's my talking, so he explained it. So essentially, I could still build, if my property was whatever, I could still build an ADU in front of my house. This isn't preventing someone from building one in front of their house, it's just putting some setbacks in there. So, okay. That's solved my question.
Excellent. Any other additional comments? No. All right. Motion 4 is to approve AB 25020, an ordinance amending ordinance of government chapters 18.06, 18.10, and 18.30 related to accessory dwelling units to be used as a first and final reading. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And opposed? Okay, thank you for everybody. Totally passes and commands. Thank you for that. Okay, item number 12, AB 25-021, motion authorizing Iowa and Yakima Jail Services Acting Police Chief Blasey. Please come to the podium. Could you come to the podium?
I'm back.
Okay, you are back. We appreciate that.
Good evening, Council. The proposal before you is, with the rising cost of jail services, which we discussed pretty in-depth over the last quarter of the month as everybody was preparing the budget. Costs have gone up. So the Farmington Police Department has been looking at options to be a little more fiscally responsible for both cities in presenting options for us that allow us to house inmates, especially those on long-term commitments over 30 days, in facilities that cost us less per day. Last August, September time frame, Yakima County Jail reached out to us. Both cities used to have a contract with them. A lot of cities did. They quit taking contracts with outside agencies during COVID. They're now bringing those back, and they reached out to us, so we started having discussions, and that's how this came about. If you look at the agenda bill, you'll see that I listed out some costs from what we're currently paying with our current services. So Issaquah is $150 a day with a $20 fee. Sunnyside, which y'all approved on consent earlier, is $68.99 a day with no booking fee. That is used for a long-term commit. However, they only house males. So when we look at long-term commits for females, we're looking at either Issaquah and or SCORE. So when you look at those fees, our daily rates are $273.39 for King County per day, and then $204.97 per day. And if you look to the left, you'll see those booking fees, which are quite, SCORE $65. SCORE, King County, and Sunnyside all have medical options and mental health options. So does Yakima. So Yakima, when we look at this new proposal, it's a guarantee. It's a non-guaranteed bed. We call and see if they have availability. They will do the transports either from Issaquah, SCORE, King County, or a designated meeting area that we set up, and it's $125 a day. They house female inmates, and they also have a medical and mental health services, which then is $172.92 a day. So ultimately, in the grand scheme of things, this provides us an option, and it allows us to book those who are on long-term commits at a lower cost, especially when it comes to those who are female, and saves us, up to, anywhere from $75 a day up. So that's kind of where this came about. Again, we both cities have had this previous contract. We're just trying to re-implement it and give another tool in our tool bag that allows us to book and lower cost to both cities. Any questions?
Comment on this agenda item, we'd like to come to the podium at this time. If you have a request for accommodation, sit up here if you wish to speak. Please raise your hand through the virtual platform, and we'll take your comments after in-person comments. Please remember to state your name, your address, and if you're in this to speak.
Senior Bay Russian.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you.
Motion to approve 825-021, authorizing the mayor to execute and administer an interlocal agreement with Yakima County Department of Corrections for jail services in a form and content acceptable to the city attorney.
Second.
No, I said.
Okay.
Thank you. Motion
to request that you sit by the city hotel. Do you have a comment to make? Just appreciative of Snoqualmie. Police looking for ways for a drunk to save some money. This is a good option.
Excellent.
Excellent. Thank you, Scott. Help you out.
Yeah, I mean, it just shows that we're looking for other ways to save money on our public safety, considering it's one of the largest points of the item, and that's really one of the reasons brought forward to this board is to show not a lot of opportunities, but we're trying as we can, and costs continue to go up. Period.
Any comments on the motion before us is to approve AB 25-021, authorizing the mayor to execute the minister the interlocal agreement with Yakima County Department of Corrections and Jail Services and informing content acceptable to the city attorney. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you for that. Passes unanimously. And moving right along quickly now, item 13, AB 25-022, motion authorizing amendment number one to complete work. Order number
2024-4. Mr. Burke, can you provide that? Thank you, Dr. Ray. So, in October last year, the City Council approved a work order for about $169,000 for the Keithley Library to replace the existing ground and backup generator on the workshop facility with a trailer mounted unit that was salvaged from the wastewater treatment plant during the upgrades. This need was discussed during the city's decision process in fall of 23. The primary driver for this is opening up the public works admin building for emergency management. Currently, that building does not have backup power. This project will provide that backup power as well as the backup power for the public works shop. The work included replacing the generator and replacing the existing automatic transfer switch with a larger unit that would handle the additional power. The original scope of that work included taking the generator off of the trailer that it's currently mounted on, mounting it to the ground and rewiring the generator from the existing 480 volt AC that it currently puts out to 240 volt AC that the building currently uses. After we got started on the work, city staff got together and discussed it and decided it would be more advantageous to keep that generator mobile and keep it at the 480 volt AC. The reason for that is if we lost one of our other generators at one of our remote water or sewer sites, we could take that generator out to one of those higher priority sites to provide backup power in the interim. So if we keep it mobile, it's going to increase levels of service for the water and sewer. Because of this decision, there are three changes that need to be made to the scope of work. The first one is that we will need to install a step-down transformer to convert the generator power from 480 volts to 240 volts. That is going to allow that generator in its current condition to feed that building. The second change is that the ATS that was originally purchased for the project, it was one of the first purchases on the project due to the long lead time, was a three-pole ATS. With the addition of the transformer, we will need a four-pole ATS to meet National Electric Code for bonding and grounding requirements. One thing to know about this is that the three-pole ATS that was originally purchased can be used at one of our water sites in which the ATS cracked out on us a couple of years ago. So we will be able to make that site whole again with the ATS that we already purchased. The third change is they will need to rent a scissor lift and a forklift to install the larger four-pole ATS. That wasn't necessary with the three-pole ATS, it's smaller of a unit, so they need that equipment to do the work. These changes add up to about $48,000, including tax. which brings the total project cost to $217,109. The amount budgeted initially was $180,000, and it was included in the 25-26 budget. The additional money for this is expected to come out of money that was originally allocated for City Hall parking lot electrical charging stations. Those are now largely grant funded, so we're taking some of the savings from that project and expecting to apply it to this project. So with that, I will take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bird. Any questions for Don? Okay, if any members of the audience would like to comment on this agenda item, we would like to come forward to this time. Pause. We have request accommodation to City Clerk Commission to speak. Please raise your hand to the virtual platform and we'll take your comments after in virtual. For any person comments, please remember to state your name or address and 3 minutes to speak.
No one at this time, Your Honor.
Thank you for that. I'll move right along to Councilmember Colin Hinn, who's next. This is number 4. Motions to make.
Yep.
I follow this.
The Internet Committee.
You know it.
Motion to approve AB25-02022, authorizing the mayor to execute amendment number 1 to work order number 2024-4 with Keithley Electric Company for replacing the public workshop generator.
We have a second.
I'll second.
Who wants it? Okay.
Doesn't matter.
Okay, Ms. Rustic. Okay, motion made by Ms. Golan, second by Ms. Rustic. Ms. Golan, do you have a comment to make the motion?
I think having a generator is very important, especially in our neck of the woods with all the power outages that we go through. And it's very needed.
Excellent. Thank you, Ms. Rustic. Do you have any comments for me?
I don't have any additional comments. Thank you.
Perfect. Anybody else in the same have any comments to make?
Sure.
Just wonderful thinking outside of the box to put redundancy in the system at a lower cost and to the benefit of everybody providing public services is at the core of what we all seek to do. So thank you.
Very good. This motion before us is to approve 25-022, authorizing the mayor to execute amendment number 1 to work order number 2024-4, the Keithley Electric Company for replacing the public workshop generator. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. That passes unanimously. Thank you, everybody. Item number 14, AB25-023, motion authorizing purchase of an ambulance. Mr. Rivas, you're on.
Good evening, Council. Page 117 in your packet, it's a pretty straightforward agenda bill. It's just a purchase of a man lift, genie, cherry picker, whatever you want to call it. Our past practice is to rent this equipment. We do it about 5 to 15 times per year. Costs are $12,000 to $15,000 roughly per year. This is a request from our maintenance division of public works for improved delivery speed or level of service, however you want to call it. I kind of look at this thinking to myself, if you didn't own a car, but you needed a car 5 to 15 times per year, would you go and rent a car, go to Enterprise, wherever, to rent a car, or would you just go buy one? So that's kind of where we're at. I think it makes financial sense to do this. Again, this is really about level of service and delivery speed for the community. That is the report.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Clarifying question. Is there a retail outlet within the city limits of North Bend that sells jeans such that the sales tax will revert to the city?
Thank you.
No, they don't sell them out there. It's a transfer site.
Shoot.
Go knock on the door now.
Oh, Ms. Rustic.
Yeah, thank you. Just for. There were other options looked at as we, and decided what was the best solution, correct? And it appears that the option to purchase a less expensive used van lift wasn't ideal, and that any type of maintenance costs were taken into consideration, and it looked like it has an ROI of approximately 7 years, correct?
Yeah, I would say so. 7 to 8 years, there's insurance and a few other items, but we tend to keep equipment for 20 to 30 years, so.
Okay, just having the net left available makes sense, and just wanted to make sure that it was a good economic decision, so thank you.
Any other clarifying questions? Okay, if any members of the audience would like to comment on this agenda item, we would invite you to come forward to the podium at this time. If you have just requested accommodation with the city clerk and wish to speak, please raise your hand through the virtual platform and we'll take your comments after in-person comments. Please remember to name your city name and introduce your appearance to speak.
No one online this time.
Thank you. Councilmember Corolla, please make this motion.
Motion to approve AB25-023, authorizing the purchase of a 2025 Genie Z45 XC diesel particulating boom man lift in an amount not to exceed $102,330 plus tax through Washington State DES contract 02520, and authorizing the mayor to execute any applicable contracts in form and content acceptable to the city.
Thank you. Do we have a second?
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Grotel. The motion made by Ms. Colin and second by Mr. Grotel. Ms. Colin, do you have any comments to make?
I do. So I was on the fence on this one a while back when we were talking about it, but then I realized this motion will help our city workers be more efficient with their jobs and will provide consistent equipment for them to work with.
Very good. Mr. Grotel.
Nothing to add.
Excellent. Anybody
else? Ms. Gossett. Yes. In looking at the sales order, it doesn't use the word manlift. And so it appears to me that manlift is shorthand introduced by staff, and I would encourage that either you mentioned cherry picker or some other term. I expect some staff on occasion might not be men who get lifted up in this piece of equipment. And we've also had a history in this town of making certain pieces of equipment, having naming contests in Darth Grader. Darth Grader was one. I'm going to propose the Elastic Girl and leave it at that thing.
No, I just wanted to point out the invoice. We get a pretty good hefty discount on this, so it seems like a good purchase. And I like, what do you call it? The Master Girl?
Well, I had in committee, I discussed how I would approve this and endorse it so long as we have a larger Christmas tree.
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right. Anybody else? Okay. See, the motion for us is to approve AB25-023, authorizing the purchase of the 2025 Genie X45XC diesel articulating boom, man lift, in an amount not to exceed $102,300 plus tax, sales tax through Washington State DES contract 02520, authorizing the mayor to execute ethical contracts and for the content acceptable to the city attorney. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Sorry, we were okay. We were just here. Thank you for this. Okay, motion passes unanimously. Thank you, one all. Item 15, AB25-24, motion authorizing PSC contract for 2024 sidewalk gas project. Mr. Rico, so I look back to you by the report.
Yeah, page 125 of your packet, another pretty straightforward agenda bill. This is two sidewalk gas projects on Orchard Drive and Cedar Falls. There's approximately 5 light poles that we would like to purchase. That includes the poles, the arms, the luminaires, the wiring, and make those final connections. And Puget Sound Energy would do this. The construction of those projects is pretty much done except for this. There were some design changes, otherwise this would have been done sooner. And then we were waiting for costs, and then November 19th windstorm hit, so that kind of slowed things down for PSC. And so that hasn't been super pressing. We've been pretty busy lately in public works. Took a little while to get the final cost and the design. The design's included as one of exhibits, Exhibit B. But in the interest of public safety, I think having lighting on Cedar Falls Way and Orchard Drive are important, and so I'd recommend this move forward.
Yes. Can you remind me, this was part of the original project, and we just didn't have the final cost, so now this is an amount above what was in the total budget for the project?
I don't have that with me, what the budget was for this project. We had a slew of sidewalk gap projects in 2024. On Orchard Drive, we did North Bend Way, we did Cedar Falls Way. I don't have that answer for you.
Trevor?
You mentioned this in committee, there's a car slides off the road, hits one of these poles. What is the approximate replacement cost?
So this pole would be owned by PSE, so their insurance company would pay for it.
Right, I'm just saying, like, you don't do this, it costs the city like $10,000, or what are the ones these poles cost?
Oh, if we acquire the poles themselves, not from PSE?
Yeah. I just want to just highlight this is insurance policy for us, right?
Yeah, I haven't priced it out, so.
I can actually answer that question. It's about $35,000 to $40,000.
Wow.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That sounds like a good
thing. Nice work.
Clarify the question. Just any sense of the visual? I mean, there's streetlights in the inside of you. Do they look like those? But there's light coming down from the inside of the globe, or any physical description? Do we know what the light fixtures are going to look like?
Yeah, I think there's an exhibit.
And I don't mean to delay us any longer than we were kind of mess. I just wanted some general sense that there's attention being paid to light fusion and trying to throw light down towards the ground and then up towards the
sky. So they should be matching the other poles that are out there that are already on
the same pole. That's the best answer.
Anybody else? Okay,
Mr.
Chair, I'll move on to this agenda.
Motion to approve AD25-024, authorizing the mayor to execute the lighting contract with PSE for the 2024 sidewalk gaps project in an amount not to exceed $83,028.60 in a form and content approved by the city attorney. Thank you very much. Next second.
I was waiting to give somebody else the ability to second.
As Mark Rodriguez said, it's about safety for our citizens, and lighting will make it a little bit safer.
Yeah, I agree. The final line of the summary is basically insurance policy makes a lot of sense.
Any other council comments? Seeing none, motion for us is to approve AD25-024, authorizing the mayor to execute this lighting contract for PSC for the 2024 sidewalk gas project, and amount not to exceed $83,028.60 in the form and content approved by the city attorney. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? That passes unanimously once again. Thank you, everybody. Item number 16, AB25-025, motion authorizing section 4F, acquisitions de minimis, impacts and occurrence letter. Mr. Rico, please.
Thank you. Page 133 in your packet. Since it's after 10 o'clock, I'll be fairly brief, but happy to answer any questions. What we're really doing with this particular agenda bill is one of our most complicated transportation capital projects is the Southport Avenue extension and Starfish roundabout projects. We've received grant funds for the engineering design of this project and also for the construction of this project. for the roundabout geometry, it's at North Bend Way, 8th Street, and South Park Avenue, which you will see on Exhibit B. To get the roundabout geometry to work for those five legs, there is some need to repurpose city lands from its current conservation to transportation. So that is Tongate Farm Park, where that connection comes in. One of the requirements for this project is to undergo what's called NEPA. It's the National Environmental Policy Act, which is the national equivalent of the local CEPA. And anytime you make impacts to recreational lands or conservation lands, such as this, what we're proposing here, is we need to bring this forward to City Council as part of a public event here and inform you that we intend to move forward with this in order to finish the design of this project and build this project. Also attached with this agenda bill is a draft letter of concurrence offered by our mayor that's attached here, which WashDOT will need to receive from the city, that we understand that we are requiring lands that are recreational or wildlife or historic in need and converting those to transportation use. So I'm happy to try to answer any questions if there are any. There is a motion associated with this agenda bill, and it's really about the acquisitions of the minimus impact concurrence letter. So we're currently with this project about 60% design. We still intend to finish the design in 2025, early 26, and it's possible we can construct this project, start construction of this South Fork Avenue extension in summer 2026 is when we can start this project.
Great. Thanks, Mr. Rigos. Any clarifying questions? Ms. Ferguson.
And look at the map. If you're going towards the casino on North Bend Way and you look to your right on Northeast Bay, there's a little house here in the corner. It looks like with this new project, that part of the road that was Northeast 8th is no longer going to be there. Is that true?
That's correct, yeah. That little segment, but they will still be provided access with the new driveway.
Okay, and so that lot, that's what you're saying, is that the house that's right there, they have access.
They will have access.
Does that lot, is that just one lot? Or the question is like, is there another lot there that someone potentially might put a house and need access to, road, or is that all just one lot?
I think it's just one lot. The zoning of that, I'm looking over at my planners to see if they might know. Maybe Mike knows what that area was on my own. Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot. I don't know what the zoning is there, but it's possible that lot could be short flat in two lots or subdivided into four more, or it could be converted to commercial if that property is zoned commercial.
Did we communicate with them and they were okay with us doing this?
There has been a conversation from Tom Moore, that property owner, and I'm virtually certain because I asked that question a couple months ago. So.
Thank you. Any other clarifying questions?
I could be wrong. We've been talking about this roundabout my entire time on council, but in my memory, and I may be wrong, the roundabout was not on north on that road. It was a little bit like closer to Nintendo. This is my memory off.
You've been on TPW committee since 2020, I believe, and we had several alternatives that we looked at. One had two mini roundabouts, and we had one larger roundabout. I think there was a discussion a couple of years ago. I'm pretty sure there was one that we wanted to move forward with this five-leg roundabout. But yeah, that was probably 2022, 2023 or so. Probably when Ross Loudenbeck was the chair of TBW committee.
And to add, so you think this will divert a large amount of traffic off of our main drag to make traffic better?
I think that this will mitigate for the upcoming commercial projects that are going to happen in the Meadowbrook area as a result of sewer being provided to those properties. Public sewer is going to be provided to 68 parcels out there. Those parcels cannot easily develop without public sewer. Some of those properties will have large buildings with a lot of trips. And if we don't have a second access for them, which would be South Park Avenue and easy access and that Starfish roundabout, then they will worsen the level of service at our main, our primary intersection, which is North Bendway and 202, which, as you probably know, in the current condition, it doesn't pass our concurrency. In the afternoons, that intersection can back up where vehicles are all the way past our wastewater treatment plant over the bridge and down to 202, because there's no other easy way to get through that traffic intersection in North Bendway and Bendigo Boulevard. So this will solve an existing problem and will mitigate a future problem if we don't do anything about it. So I feel really strongly that this is in the best interest of the city.
Anybody else? Okay, the motion for us is to approve 8895-025, authorizing the mayor.
Mayor, I don't think Heather made a motion yet.
Oh, boy. Changing my colors here, I guess. Let's do, if any members of the audience would like to comment on this agenda item, we can invite you to come forward to the podium at this time. If you have requested accommodation of the city clerk, you wish to speak, please raise your hand from the virtual platform and we'll take your comments after in-person comments. Please remember to speak your name or say your name. 3 minutes to speak. Okay. Ms. Coleman.
Motion to approve 8025-025, authorizing the mayor or designee to sign the section 4F acquisitions de minimis impact concurrence.
Thank you. Do we have a second?
Second.
Mr. Johnson. A motion made by Ms. Coleman and a second by Mr. Johnson. Ms. Coleman, do you have any comments to make?
It is my true hope that it really helps mitigate our traffic that we have in Redmond.
Thank you. And Mr. Johnson, any comments?
No.
Okay. Anybody else any comments? No. The motion before us is to approve 8025-025, authorizing the mayor or designee to sign the section 4F acquisitions de minimis impact and concurrence letter. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? That passes unanimously. So once again, thank you, everybody. And I think we're getting close to wrapping up. But before that, we're going to bounce to Mayor, Council, and Administrator Concerns and Initiatives. And let's start with Brendan.
Collaborative that I participated in, along with the mayor, Councilmember Brusick, Councilmember Coleman. Just exciting, a lot of great ideas. Great to see massive collaboration amongst various groups in the cities. So, more to come, but excited to participate in that coming up in another 2 weeks.
Thank you, Mayor Fulton.
My comments are to them, Mr.
Well, you're on a roll. I love it. Okay, Mr. Rustin, follow that one.
No, I can't. Nothing tonight, thank you.
Okay, Mr. Rustin.
Yeah, just real quick, probably you all know the same thing. We just had daylight savings time, which means more light in the afternoon and more people out on the roads walking and around. So please be careful, watch your speeds so that everybody can get home safe. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Larson.
Nothing to
Well, that's worse as we come back tonight. A lot of great things to say. For the Downtown Foundation to keep it local to Palmy Valley, I invite you to join them Wednesday, March 19th from 8 to 9 a.m. at the North Bend Training Network for Meetup Cleanup Events. Come grab some gloves, grab some sticks, find some little vests, garbage bags, and get to know your neighbors all while you're helping to beautify downtown.
Any time is a great time to adopt a pet from the Regional Animal Services of King County. For this month, you're going to make it a lot easier to find a new friend and the best one. In fact, through March 31st, you can adopt any cat or kitten for just $30, the cost of a pet license. Well, you have dozens of friendly, fuzzy felines for you to choose from. That was rough stuff for me to say. Stop by the Pet Adoption Center in Kent to find out more information online at its website. And the yard waste recycling program will start Saturday, April 5th from 8 a.m. to noon. And the works program is open on select Saturdays through October. It is available to all who reside in the 9045 zip code area. To find out more about the program, including a list of days of the event being open and sample materials to bring, please visit the news section of the city. So thank you all for staff, council, our wonderful people that came and presented and in the audience and online. Thank you for joining us tonight and have a wonderful week. And we are adjourned. Can we say, can I say that we are?
Second. All in favor? Aye.
Thank you, everybody. Good night.
Recording.